But what have they done to you?
They made me speak against you. They've forced me to...
To say what? That you, dear nephew, and this dog of a sorcerer, are in league to revive the blasphemous cult of Demnos.
You stinking butcher!
My lord, all over the city, they're coming out of every street.
What are you gabbling about?
The brethren, they're moving towards the temple.
This is Bristol. Apologies for starting 5 minutes late today. We are now sharing this studio with some organisation that does music, and we arrived today to find the place absolutely various things unplugged, etc., etc. So we're struggling to, and Dave Basenko has done a fantastic job in getting it all working. Plugging the right things into the right things that have been unplugged. So it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 16th of February 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Aurora is one of the best ones. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is on the line. Part one, we'll be looking at the UK is now in a slump, officially not great for Rishi Sunak and the Tories, and by-election victories by Labour, surprise, surprise, yesterday, as well as we're hearing from a chap called Jordan Durante. When I first spoke to him last year, Jordan had millions of pounds, he believes, stolen off of him when his grandfather, who was the treasurer of the Freemason United Grand Lodge in London, Covent Garden, was murdered. He says he was murdered anyway. It certainly looks like he was. So we'll be hearing from him. And also this whole idea of trust fraud. So the idea is, you know, this money is now controlled by people that were not in the will. This sort of thing. In part two, the death of Alexei Navalny by some sort of weapon, or what's going on there. The Russians are wondering, how did they do that? The Munich Security Conference, handily, is just starting, and Zelensky's, where he threatened 2 years ago to get equipped with nuclear weapons, if you remember that, just before the Russians invaded eastern Ukraine. We'll be hearing from the Russian ambassador to London. He'll be talking about that. We also hope to have on the line Vanessa Bealey talking about Qatar, Jordan, and the wider Middle East conflict. Her father was British ambassador to Syria decades ago, but she's pretty good on all this stuff, Vanessa. And also we're going to be hearing from Matt Campbell, whose brother was killed in the 9/11 attacks. He's got another crowdfunder where he's trying to raise some money to reopen the inquest into his brother's death. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. It's cancelled off Bristol Community FM, that's us, by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. So I'm also joined in the studio by Isaac Kneebone Hopkins. Hi, Isaac.
Hello, how's it going?
Very well, thanks. And you, I know, have been looking at looking ahead of the horizon a little bit, haven't you, by checking out the... what's it called? The
committee system.
Yeah, the committee system, yeah. So if you could just, before we end, I mean, we'll get Martin to comment, because we know we've had this mayor system, or some would call the nightmare system, for the last, 12 years, I think it is now. And there was a referendum a couple of years ago, or a year ago, saying we didn't actually want to have a mayor anymore. And so in this election, that's the end of the mayor, and we're now going back to the committee system. So can you just give us an idea of what we're going to be expecting after May?
So, yeah, after May, so we're getting rid of the mayor. We're going to have a council lead instead. So the council lead will be elected by the councillors instead of by people directly, which means they're also removable by the councillors, which is kind of interesting. And then after that, there's also going to be 9 committees which will cover different areas of policy. This will, you know, housing, environment, and then there's a strategy and resources one, which will kind of be the replacement for the cabinet. It'll be chaired by the council lead, and will be kind of responsible via a subcommittee for doing the budget and that sort of thing. The theory being that the power will be shared a lot more equally amongst the different parties.
Well, when you say council lead,
yes,
what do you mean by it's not? This is just another mayor, is it?
So it's kind of, it's a sort of weird one, because in theory they are a figurehead. In the kind of constitution it says they'll be a political figurehead. So they don't really have power in the same way as the mayor. They don't have the veto that the mayor had, which we saw with, like, you know, refusing to reopen the toilets after the Acorn campaign, moving the Filton Stadium, or to Filton, that sort of stuff, which the mayor kind of overruled councillors to do. The new council lead won't be able to do that. Their kind of main job will be to sort of represent the city, so they'll talk to, like, central government, the Weka mayor, that sort of stuff, and they'll chair this sort of strategy and resources.
Okay, so what we've got really is an old-fashioned style council leader.
Yes, it very much is kind of, they call it the new model, but it's not entirely clear what's that new about it. It'll be very similar to how it kind of used to be, I would say, although with the difference that now there will be probably a lot more Green Party councillors and that sort of thing.
Well, they almost certainly will, especially since the ruling Labour group in Bristol seem to be very unpopular. They're slated for the general election in probably in November the 14th, I keep hearing. There was almost certain to be for the first time, a Green MP here in Bristol. So the Greens are definitely on the up in the city. But look, the main thing is, what difference is there in the system? You're talking about the mayor having a veto. But at the moment, it almost seems as if the council, I mean, we have many councillors on here over the last 12 years. God, far too many, probably. But most of them saying, well, we have very little power.
I think the fact them saying they don't have power isn't true, right? Like, they are in charge of the budget. I mean, that's been an issue with the implementation of the committee system that I'm sure we'll get to later. And I, you know, they can always overrule councillors. They get to kind of pick policy, kind of direction and all that sort of stuff. Under this new system, the idea will be there'll be chairs of each committee that will be selected by councillors. If one party has a majority, they can, in theory, take all the chairs, and then it will actually be very similar to how it is now. The majority party will have all the power. Although the Greens did tell me that they didn't intend to take all the chairs of the committees. Labour...
Well, hang on, because we had that before with the mayors, didn't we? Actually, George Ferguson was pretty good in keeping all of the different parties in, but with Marvin Rees, he began with what they call a rainbow cabinet with lots of different parties in there, and quite quickly decided, no, it's all going to be my friends, my Labour colleagues that are in the cabinet. So this, they can start off with good intentions, but it might not necessarily carry on like that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. A lot of this is never going to be finished. Like, all the councillors I spoke to were like, oh, it's not going to be a finished process. It's something we have to keep working on afterwards. And that can go either way. It could be that they kind of try and put in more democratic stuff in there, more accountability for themselves, although I don't think many politicians often get around to doing that bit of increasing the scrutiny on them.
Well, so the way it works is the council leader is from the party of which has the largest number of councillors. I think we have, isn't it, 70 councillors or so?
Yes.
And so whoever gets the largest number of that, they are the council leader. But then they have quite a lot of checks and balances on them. So they're not able to just do what they want. They have to persuade rather than bludgeon through policies. Like, for example, maybe you could say something about this, Isaac, because the mayor has changed enormously the way the city's run, particularly these policy bodies. He brought in this thing called the One City Plan, which seems to have actually ended up being very divisive.
Yeah, I think it will still be the case that the biggest party will be able to really kind of change the ground underneath everyone. Like, because the constitution actually, I think, is now, even though it could in theory be changed before, like, now it can be changed a lot. You can add new committees, you can take committees away. So the biggest party will still have the power to really, like, you know, formulate the power in the city around what they're trying to do.
Yeah, look, this One City Plan has been extremely controversial. Certainly my understanding of it is that the councillors really don't like it. The idea is effectively you've got these policy making bodies supported by the mayor, where he basically just picks a few people that he gets on with and likes to make policy in that area. I mean, a famous example being housing, where Acorn were excluded from that, even though they represent hundreds of people across the city are having trouble with their housing, and in fact they had a protest where they actually closed the meeting down, because, you know, this is no way to run a democratic city, spending 1.2 to 1.3, Guy Pulteney was telling me the other day, million. billion of our money. It's billion, actually. A lot of money. So this is on capital projects and the regular spending day-to-day of the council. And it's quite important that there is some democratic accountability in there. So the one city plan, is that going? Do you know?
It was one of those things where different councillors sort of... I didn't really get into that in the article because it's kind of it's a whole thing in itself and would take another sort of 1,000 words to explain. It was kind of... Some of the councillors want to get rid of it, some of them don't. One of the benefits, I guess, of the system is that actually on a committee, what you have is, instead of before where a cabinet member goes, all right, I want to do this, an officer goes away and makes a report on how they'll do that, and then they go, great, we'll put that through. Now, on the committees, actually the opposition parties can go, well, we would like to maybe do this instead, or we'll do this instead, which means that you will have reports of all of those different options. So I think even if you did keep the one city plan and that kind of, I think that lack of democratic oversight with kind of, you know, elite stakeholders from business often, you would still have to, as long as, you know, councillors ask for this. And that is the thing. It does all come down to what the councillors have the will to actually try and do. But they will be able to still kind of have the alternate options and kind of hear them out properly. I think one of the things, though, is that realistically, like, as much as to say all these decisions will happen in these committees, they're not going to happen there. Like, that will be the place where the kind of theatre happens and where, you know, nerds like myself can go and sit in and watch them, maybe ask questions or whatever. But realistically, a lot of stuff is still going to go behind the scenes. Like, a big part of this that I sort of, the research I did was looking at Sheffield. And in Sheffield, Ruth, who started It's Our City campaign there, which they forced a referendum by using a petition of 20,000 people. But her concern was actually more power can be dragged towards the officers who are, like, you know, the staff of the council, unless there's a lot of input from citizens and their elected representatives as councillors. It's quite easy with this big increase of work for the kind of power to be taken into, you know, unaccountable bureaucrats, really. And I think that is going to be one of the issues. And if, you know, the councillors do choose to keep kind of engaging with, you know, rich people who build houses instead of the people who are defending people who live in those houses, it might be that we don't see that much of a change at all, even with a lot more of these kind of potentially democratic trappings.
Oh dear. Doesn't sound very good, does it?
No, I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, I was supportive of the committee system during the referendum because I did feel that, like, it was bad that the mayor could just overrule something when all the councillors that we all voted for had tried to vote for something, right? I think that's really bad. The problem is that actually this sort of implementation has seemingly been quite underfunded. Like, compared to Sheffield, they had, like, two members of staff working on top of their full-time roles as part of the implementation. In Sheffield, they had, like, around 13 or something. And, you know, this is the implementation thing here had none of its own resources in the budget. So whether they've
really... This is a bit cheeky, isn't it? This is surely is the mayor saying, well, you voted against me, so, you know, up yours, and I'm not going to really supply you with the members of staff and the budget that you need in order to implement it.
That was certainly the allegations that I had heard sort of from people, which is sort of what led to my sort of investigation of the sort of process. I should add that the council did deny that when I put it to them. Although Lorraine Francis in the Greens did sort of heavily nod towards that having been part of the thing, that, you know, the reason they couldn't get more staff and more money was because it all had to go through the mayor. And we did see that actually when the system was eventually voted on in full council, everyone voted in favour of it except for the mayor, who abstained. So he has made it quite clear at every opportunity that he thinks it's a bad idea. And I think it's right that people are suspicious that it seems to have been not given all the support it needs to be successful.
So how would you sum up the 8 years we've had of Mayor Marvin Rees? I think it's too much in the past, really, to try and, you know, I think look at George Ferguson when he was mayor for the 4 years before that. But how would you characterise the last 8 years? And I mean, obviously the people of Bristol have voted to get rid of the whole position of mayor. That they've sent a pretty clear signal by doing that. What about yourself?
So I think that Marvin Rees he's sort of an interesting character, right? He's one of the few kind of prominent Labour politicians in the city who, during Corbynism, despite the fact that I suspect he wasn't a big fan of Corbyn, he did just sort of never, ever say anything about him ever. Which, you know, to be fair, I can see that. You know, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. But I think the Labour Party in Bristol are particularly effective at sort of shutting down kind of energy to their left. And I think Marvin has sort of continued that sort of proud tradition that the party's been doing here for decades. It was all about him. I think one of his issues is that he would always take minor disagreements as major personal slights. I think we've seen this in his clashes with the press, like the banning of Alex Seabrook from like press briefings and things like that.
Well, I just illustrate that, because Alex is one of these local democracy reporters, and you're talking about, oh, you know, going along to these council meetings. Quite a lot of them are quite boring, but you know, someone's got to be there. Alex is one of those.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Like, there's so few journalists now who have the time and in the way that they're paid to go along to these very long and bureaucratic meetings. And the thing that you find is actually at them, there's lots of, they can be very interesting stuff that's very relevant to people's day-to-day lives. And I think by this kind of hostile relation to any criticism that the Labour administration has shown for the last 8 years, it has really kind of diminished opportunities to hold them accountable and, you know, frankly, to produce better policy. Like, we're seeing this with Acorn and the Barton House stuff. If they had just engaged properly and meaningfully with Acorn and the people who lived in that place, then they could have, like, done something, like, stopped all this ill will, actually got everything solved much quicker and much cheaper. And I think it's going to be the legacy of this administration, is this refusal to engage seriously with people who have even minor criticisms and correct criticisms. And I think that is why people have pushed for the committee system here. I mean, when you compare it to Sheffield, like in Sheffield, they had this thing called the tree scandal, where due to a private contract that was put out, thousands of trees were cut down that didn't need to be. And then when people tried to protest that, they were literally prosecuted. And I think at one point they were accused of poisoning the people who are cutting down the trees. They hadn't done that. And they've had their lives ruined for trying to hold their Labour council, their supposedly, you know, left-wing party, to account to do progressive things. And we don't have that kind of major smoking gun in Bristol. Like, there's these smaller things, like the stadium and stuff like that, the arena. The feeling is the same.
Excuse me, what arena?
The arena that has been moved from the...
Hang on. There's nothing happening. I drove past there the other day up in Filton.
Oh, yes. No, currently no arena. But, you know, there's a theory of an arena, a potential arena.
It's definitely not going to be by Templemead Station, where everybody seemed to want it. No, but... and it's not even... It looks like, to me, maybe going to be up in Filton either.
Yeah, well, why would you want an arena with thousands of capacity where people could actually get to it quite easily? That would be ridiculous. But yeah, I think like the administration has kind of forced people's hand towards the committee system, and they've been quite kind of resistant to it the whole way. Like I mean, you even saw what, like, the only sort of Labour councillor who didn't vote against the referendum was Zoe Goodman, who's now quit the party, who abstained. Like, they've obviously been trying to kind of keep a lid on this desire for more democracy in the city, which is sort of representative of their approach all the way through, I think. Which has been a shame, especially in Bristol, where actually during Marvin's tenure, there has been this big surge of people who wanted to, like, make the Labour Party more democratic and more speaking to working class people.
Now, Martin, you've been sitting patiently waiting, listening there. Could you say something about the Labour Party during COVID? Because I remember there was a terrible row, some great long meeting that went on long into the evening. I think it was Bristol West, maybe, Labour Party. And they eventually decided from Labour Central Office through Keir Starmer to suspend the party and to run it directly from head office. So there does seem to be a bit of a battle between the left and the right, particularly in Bristol, within the Labour Party.
Yeah, well, I think you're referring to the Zoom meeting where the committee for, they were re-electing the officers for Bristol West, and we all logged in because we had to be done on Zoom, and lots of people couldn't get to vote. And I stayed to the bitter end and got a vote, but lots of people you know, they were waiting to vote, and they've said it was all technical and that they couldn't get the people to vote. And, of course, there was lots of suspicion that this was a stitch-up by the full-time officials of the Labour Party to make sure that Bristol West had a pliable, you know, committee running it, because obviously Bristol West had the biggest Labour Party membership in the country and was solidly pro-Corbyn. Now, none of the Labour MPs in the city are Corbyn fans at all. They were very hostile to the whole Corbyn phenomenon. But, of course, a lot of the people who were in the party at that time, including me, and I've been a member since 1975, so I wasn't brought into the party by Corbyn, but a lot of people were. And a lot of effort went into controlling those people. And, of course, now many of them have left the Labour Party. But, of course, what is happening, Bristol West is probably the most radical constituency in the country, previously represented by the Liberal Democrats because of the Valerie Davies abstention on the Iraq war vote when she was a Labour MP. And I think that it's quite feasible that this that the Greens will take the council in May. And, of course, I think they already control all of the wards in the new Bristol Central a constituency, so they must think they have a fair chance of taking the constituency. And that really is the Labour Party throwing away its core voters. That's what that is.
So, Martin, will you be leaving the Labour Party and joining the Greens?
Sorry?
Will you be leaving the Labour Party and joining the Greens?
No, I won't. I'm actually in Bristol East now because the constituency boundary's been redrawn. So Kerry McCarthy is my MP rather than Thangam Debonair. But both Thangam and Darren Jones and Karen Smith are all members of Labour Friends of Israel. And I think this is going to be quite important in the election. It's quite likely that the election, that people think what the election is going to be about is cost of living crisis or whatever. It could be about world war and what side you're on. And I think the first-past-the-post system means that these kind of radical forces can be repressed for a time. But obviously at certain points, it's like magma coming out of it and turning into lava and coming out of a volcano. Bristol West is probably, which will now be Bristol Central, that those people who probably did vote for Corbyn and wanted a Corbyn prime ministership, they will probably vote Green. In fact, I know quite a lot of people who have already said that to me. So in a way, this is Bristol leading the way, because Brighton's the only other place where the Greens have ever had an MP elected.
Well, hang on, because, I mean, it's the death knell of the Labour Party, of your Labour Party, which you're a member in the city, surely. The Greens are now moving in. And because of the shift to the right, the Blairite, the Mandelsonian shift to the right, there's something, they've almost become, made themselves unelectable in the city.
Yes, but of course, what they're hoping to do is pick up former Conservative voters in the red wall seats in the north. So the strategy is absolutely clear by the Starmerites, is that they want people to leave the Labour Party. They don't agree with the direction of travel. They've said the door's over there. So in actual fact, they've got the party's finances in a complete mess because they paid off staffers who claim they've been discriminated against because of anti-Semitism. The party nationally had lawyers look at it, and the lawyers said, well, if they go to court, they'll lose. But nevertheless, Starmer paid them off. That is, in fact, my subs going back to 1975, and now we haven't got any money to fight the election. But I suppose what we've seen with the two by-elections on Thursday was that despite all of that, there's such an anti-Tory sentiment in the country that they're probably going to win anyway, but we'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, we will. This week, big story, the Rochdale councillor, candidate for the Rochdale by-election, in which George Galloway is also standing, Azar Ali, he made comments that the Israelis let Hamas attack them on purpose. Basically, he's saying this is a lie hop on October the 7th. And he's been roundly condemned for saying that. But extraordinarily, Starmer has been urged to suspend all councillors who were at the meeting that heard these comments. So never mind the man that made them, he's apparently staying, but those who sat and listened to the comments that I just said, and then did not scream and shout and call him out and say, that's terrible, you can't say that, that's anti-Semitic. Not the Jewish Voice for Labour, one of the Jewish lobbies in the Labour Party is saying all of those councillors that didn't speak out in that meeting, Martin, should be suspended.
Well, as I understand it, the meeting was with Muslim community leaders to discuss the party's position on what's happening in the Middle East. And what I suspect behind all of this, actually, is that the taping of the meeting by somebody in there, this smells like an intelligence service operation to me, possibly by the Israelis, because these people in this meeting presume that they were speaking in confidence. Now, obviously it's quite easy to record people with a phone, but nevertheless, somebody in that meeting decided, and of course they leaked it to the Mail on Sunday and to the Guido Fawkes website, both of which are extremely right-wing media. And of course what's happened now is you'd have thought it should be a matter of investigation whether it was allowed to happen or not. In Israel itself, quite a lot of people are saying they're not happy with the government's account of what happened. Why did it take 7 hours for the army to turn up? Why was loads of things that, you know, loads of units were supposed to be there guarding the fence had been redeployed to the West Bank and all the rest of it. And of course, you know, as Ali said in the meeting, from what we say, he said, well, the Egyptians warned you 10 days before that this was going to happen. These are the kind of things that are being discussed openly in the Middle East. But if you say them in a meeting in Britain, you are an anti-Semite and you've got to be drummed out of politics. This is getting a bit silly. And of course, ultimately, of course, if you carry on taking that kind of control freakery approach to things, it's going to blow up in your face, because we are ultimately we've gone to war with Yemen, for example, on the back of all of this. And at some point, you know, what a British ship's going to be sunk with everybody on it. And then we're going to say, how did that happen? And it's because we've basically gone along with what the United States wants in every aspect of this. And it's shown, you know, most people in this country, I don't think, do think like that. And certainly not in the Muslim community.
Martin, some might say that actually this may get him votes, because a lot of the voters up in Rochdale also believe that the Israelis did this on purpose.
Well, I think that's what he was trying to do. He's trying to, you know, get them to feel that he was on their side. I think he's still going to be on the ballot paper. And if he wins, it will be as an independent, because the Labour Party have stopped all support for him. But on the other hand, George Galloway can come along and say, look, I'm prepared to say these kind of things, vote for me. And of course, what it does do in a rather unpleasant way is it shows how important these war and peace issues are facing this country at the moment. We're at a crossroads. We either follow the Americans over the precipice, or we look nearer by to our neighbours in Ireland, Spain, and other European countries who are saying we've got to have a ceasefire. And there's going to be a vote in Parliament next week called by the Scottish National Party, and it's going to be explosive for the Labour Party, because people are going to have to either vote for the SNP's motion or resign from the Labour front bench or whatever they have to do. And I think it's going to be it's going to be divisive, because it should be divisive. People should care about this more than anything else. It's a matter of absolute, you know, and if Starmer wants to nail his colours to those masts, he may do so. But he's going to find that there's going to be a lot of very, very determined opposition to what he's trying to do. We do not want to go to war with Yemen. We do not want to support the Israelis and what they're doing in Gaza. And I think, you know, the left is not going to stand idly by and nod their heads when that sort of thing is going on.
Well, I mean, I think there's also the fact that there's quite a sizeable ethnic minority vote up there. Too. Anyway, Isaac, what do you make of Ashar Ali's comments, and whether or not that he should be suspended? What this shows you about the level of discussion going on, particularly within the Labour Party, about the war, if you can call it, or a genocide in Gaza?
So, well, I think with regards to the recording, I don't think we need to put down, like, what is, you know, internal Labour factionalism. to a potential sort of intelligence operation.
Let's also remind everybody that this was supposed to be a confidential meeting, that people didn't believe that any of this was going to get out. And if a party can't organise confidentially, it's in a terrible state.
And I think that's one of the things, right? I think that this whole debate has and going back years, like around sort of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, has made sort of the work of people trying to do kind of proper organising in the Labour Party almost impossible. Like, when we were doing stuff, I was part of Bristol Momentum. I was actually running unelected as chair in that Bristol West meeting before they suspended me to make sure I couldn't run unelected for the biggest CLP in the country. We couldn't, like, have a meeting to try and talk seriously about the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, because we knew, even if we said, this is private, no recording, we just want to talk through properly with people to really get into this sticky issue and make sure people are on the kind of right lines with things, that was immediately going to be on the front page of all the newspapers. Like, the kind of toxic nature of the debate, I think it suited them when they could just use it just against the left. I think what's happened in Rochdale is actually they've managed to get some people who are more in sort of Starmer's camp. But because actually the genocide happening in Gaza has made it much more divisive and much less of a clear kind of left-right issue within the party, that I think what we're going to find is, with what he's said is his zero tolerance policy, that it's more and more people are going to get caught up in this. We're seeing it with the fact that they already want to suspend anyone who has sat in the room and didn't immediately jump up and stop them talking, which, frankly, if in Britain you aren't able to sit awkwardly while someone says something you disagree with, I don't know what you can do. But, you know, I think it's going to really, like, weaken the party from a position of power that they've actually managed to get themselves in, from a promising position electorally. Like, I think it's got a really good chance of, if not stopping them winning, but at least really tying their hands if they do win power in the next general election. And I think what he said is that he thought that Israel might have known about it and not done something, which, you know, we can't know if that's true or not. Like, we have some of these reports, the sort of reports that came from Egypt, but that's patently not anti-Semitic. It's not anti-Semitic to have suspicions of a far-right government. Like, if we said, oh, we think Hungary's government might, like, be up to something and might know something, people go, oh, yeah, maybe they are. They're far-right wrong-ins. Like, it has really lowered the standard of political debate. It's made it really difficult to, like, hold, like, you know, the government in Israel has some real, like, far-right nutters, people who just wouldn't be allowed to run for parliament in the UK because we'd consider them beyond the pale. And the fact that we've just gone, oh, but we'll do anything that they want to kind of support their sort of, well, foreign policy or domestic policy, however you want to put it, like, that's really sort of sad to see, and sad to see that the Labour Party has gone completely behind it. Like, it's obviously this massive issue. It's going to really cost them in the cities where you know, like you said, we have these sort of large Muslim communities, large ethnic minority communities, for whom this is a really, like, tangible and live issue. And Labour are doing it all for a kind of an imagined version of the red wall voter, even though it's something like 2/3 of the country wants an immediate ceasefire. Like, when you have neither of the major parties actually backing what most people want, like, it's obvious that we're stuck in a real problem. Like, we haven't got a proper democracy if those are our only options.
Is it a stitch-up?
I don't even know if it's a stitch-up. I think...
Hang on, we've got this thing called the Israel Lobby. We were hearing from Martin, I think it was, a minute ago. Maybe it was you, talking about all our MPs in Bristol being in the Labour Friends of Israel. Now, this is a domestic operation by the Israeli government, the Israel Lobby, isn't it?
So it's definitely a sort of the Labour Friends of Israel, and then there's Conservative Friends of Israel, both of whom have massive amounts of support in the relevant parties. So I'm working on a piece for Tribune, well, it's gone in, it'll be out in a week or so, looking at sort of anti-apartheid activism, but sort of drawing on how we can apply that to now. And one of the things I sort of was finding, it was sort of published by Declassified UK, is that British MPs have been on more paid visits to Israel than any other country in the last sort of 10 years or so. Like, hundreds. Like, fully, you know, mostly all expenses paid trips with these lobbyists to, like, basically get them on board with Israel's sort of policies towards Palestine. There is obviously this massive pull politically on politicians in the UK, funded by people who are you know, supporters of Israel, whether or not you can sort of make a direct link to the Israeli government with that or not, or just people who firmly believe in the Zionist project. Like, that's not clear to me. But there's obviously a lot of money going into getting this political backing. And, like, and we're seeing what those effects are. Like, you know, when we actually look at, like, our economic links to Israel, they're pretty negligible. Like, there's something like our 40th biggest trade partner. We send them about £6 billion of overseas investment a year, which is, like, you know, sounds like big numbers, but it's not that much in the grand scheme of things. And yet, like, the left-wing party of government in this country is seemingly willing to, like, throw away some, like, pretty easy electoral wins to kind of back a genocidal policy. Like, that's madness. Like, it's crazy that we've got to that situation and that the party has created this rod for its own back, which is forcing that situation, seemingly. I mean...
Oh, hang on. It's not crazy, Isaac, is it? It's not crazy. It's lobbying. It's successful lobbying by the Israelis.
Yes. No, I think you're right. I think there's like, yes, there's that. And I think that there's this belief that goes back to, like, the war on terror, right? Of, look, we need to be supporting democracies in the Middle East. And therefore, Israel is the perfect democracy in the Middle East, even when we see it as, like, you know, passing laws which its own citizens are having this big uprising to fight against, these sorts of judicial changes. Even in the midst of all that, we're being willing to back their government to the hilt.
It almost seems to me, well, it doesn't almost seem, it seems obvious to me that there's a deliberate attempt to undermine and subvert these democracies, to discredit the whole system by you know, infiltrating, by lobbying, by making the whole democratic process almost laughable, certainly not doing its job. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of this idea that in the UK and in Israel, in many other countries, the United States, obviously, democracy is actually under attack. Never mind, it's just not working. It's being undermined by corporate interests, by the deep state.
Well, it always was. Democracy is a work in progress in any country. It's not a finished thing, and it's been there's been a long struggle to get something approximating democracy. We're still not there. And of course, the electoral system, I hate to keep bringing this up, but it's the electoral system allows manipulation because it allows people who've got less votes to form a government. The current government got 43% of the vote and had a majority of 80 in the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah, Martin, the opposite is not another different type of democracy, a different system. It's monarchy or it's dictatorship.
Well, no, you can have proportional representation or single transferable vote, as in Ireland or Denmark, and therefore you don't get perverse results.
Well, we're getting some very perverse results here. Aren't we?
We do get perverse results here. That's exactly what happened.
Anyway, I'd just like to move on to look at the economy, because we heard on Thursday this week, it's literally the same day as we had these two by-elections, that Britain is now in recession. In fact, the news bulletins were talking about it as a slump. So we'll get both of you's views on that after we've heard this.
At the start of 2023, Rishi Sunak had been Prime Minister for just 2 months when he set out his stall.
I want to make 5 promises to you today. 5 pledges to deliver peace of mind.
First was halving inflation, then...
Second, we will grow the economy, creating better paid jobs and opportunity right across the country.
He should, he said, be judged by results.
We will either have achieved them or not. No tricks, no ambiguity. We're either delivering for you or we're not.
Uncomfortably for Mr. Sunak, these new statistics show that, in the second half of last year, the economy contracted slightly. Over the whole of 2023, things stagnated. And because the UK's population has grown, measured per person, each of us was, on average, worse off by the end of the year.
Martin, what do you make of that? It's almost laughable, isn't it? My great pledge, well, it's just not working at all. Not only is it there is no growth, it's 2 quarters now with no growth, which is a slump.
Well, it's the official definition of a recession in the textbooks. And of course, it may be that when they come to look at the figures later on, it might be that we haven't quite gone into recession. But the question is, where are we going to get out of this? Rachel Reeves has made a big deal out. She's not going to have a £28 billion investment in green technologies. So the Labour Party policy seems to be that the private sector will somehow rescue the economy from potential slump. Now, in actual fact, as somebody who studied economics, I will tell you, it won't work like that. If the private sector is not going to invest while the economy is in the doldrums, there's no sense in it. They're not going to do it.
Okay, Martin. Well,
I'm just going to rely on that as a means to get the economy going again.
Interesting.
No, and they'll have to change that policy. They've jettisoned the whole idea of it so that the City of London will accept them as the next government. But at the same time, it ties their hands so that they can't actually
If you can be concise, can you say whether you think that the economy will actually be growing by the time it comes to the general election?
Well, the stuff I've been seeing suggests that it might be able to weakly
stutter
along. But I think the general thing in the world at large, there's about to be a massive third world debt crisis, and the banking system simply can't stand for it. The banking system is shot to pieces, as it has been since 2008.
Yeah.
And the kind of tinkering approach that Rachel...
Well, let's let Isaac...
Is not going to solve
let's
that
let
problem.
Isaac chip in on this before he goes. He's got to chip off now. So, Isaac, can you give us your thoughts on this whole idea of the economy, these promises by the Goldman Sachs Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, just coming to nothing this week?
Yeah, I think it's been really, disappointing, but, maybe not surprising to see. We were being told... about a year ago, when all the strikes were happening, that we couldn't have pay rises because it was going to cause inflation. Now we're being told there might be a recession because we're all not spending enough money for some reason. This comes in the same week where British Gas reported they were having a tenfold increase in their profits, while at the same time rising fuel costs have been sort of strangling everyone's favourite pubs and cafes and stuff. The high streets are increasingly full of shut up shops. Our quality of life is just going down. All to supposedly try and save an economy, which is they've just patently failed to, improve. It's ridiculous. It's sort of, rich people get to keep making profits and poor people's lives have to get more and more miserable. And anything bad that happens is always our fault. It's the way it always is under the Tories, but I get the feeling it's not going to be wildly different under Keir Starmer, looking at it.
Yeah, really? Why? What makes you think that?
We're seeing...
We're supposed to have a choice at this election.
Oh, yeah, well, we've got a choice between the Tories being Tories and Labour's fiscal rules, which will stop them improving anything at all. But at least we'll be able to vote for someone who'll feel a bit guilty about the fact that it's getting worse instead of people who seem to sort of enjoy it. We're stuck in this rut, aren't we? Productivity is down, quality of life is down, people can't afford to get houses, everyone's favourite places to go and hang out are shutting down. The actual fabric of our lives and communities are being kind of torn apart. Basically, so rich people who currently seem to just want to live forever and go jogging and not actually enjoy their money can make more money. We're creating an economic system where no one can enjoy themselves. It's madness. It's madness. And we have no way to vote our way out of that. We have to find other means, I guess.
Yeah, we do. Your article about the council systems, and maybe you could just let us know where people can find your work online or in even an actual bit of printed newspaper somewhere.
Yes, so you'll be able to find, I've got two articles out at the moment in the print version of the Bristol Cable, which you'll be able to find in all over Bristol in random cafes and pubs and things.
If you can find any still open.
If you can find any still open, or they're probably not warm enough to be in, but if you're running very quickly in your coat and grab one, you'll be all right. And then, I've got another piece then coming out with Tribune Magazine, which will be online about the St. Paul's apartheid free zone in the 80s, which maybe I can come back and talk to you about when it's out. I've got a few other things in the cable. And on Tribune as well. So if you can find them online, you should go and have a look. It's Isaac Nebo and Hopkins.
Yeah. Thanks, Isaac. Thanks ever so much. Have you got a blog or website, a Twitter or anything like that, social media?
Oh, yeah. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm far too online on there. It's @Isaac_KH. And everything else I'll link to on there. So it's probably the best way to find me.
Okay, Isaac, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll go now to look at with Martin at our wonderful mayor, who just as I was about to come out here this afternoon, he popped up on Sky News talking about the death of Alexei Navalny. So let's have a listen to that now.
Mayor Rees, our condolences to you as Alexei Navalny's friend. Your reflections on your friend and Alexei Navalny as a significant figure in Russian politics?
Well, he's been an incredible human being. Even as I've just been waiting to come on, I've had messages popping up on my phone from the United States, from Lebanon, Dubai, Germany. Those of us who lived alongside and studied alongside Alexei when we were at Yale together, just all really heartbroken about what's happened, and also for his wife, Yulia, and their two children, who are now obviously without a husband and a father.
And when you met in Yale, he was investigating corruption in Russia, wasn't he?
He was. And just before we left, he exposed a fraud that was $3.5-4 billion. And some of our fellows, Sergei Lagodinsky, who's a Green MEP now, Lumumba Diaping, who's a diplomat from Southern Sudan, Mayakul, we're saying, Alexei, you really should think hard about not going back to Russia. This is dangerous, the level of corruption you've exposed. And he said, I have to go back. If I don't go back, they will tell the Russian people that I'm some American agent, and they'll undermine all the work that I've done. So he's committed to going back. And I'll just tell you how significant this commitment is. And as I was sitting here waiting, one evening, and Alexei and I were in the common room, just sat together, doing a little bit of last-minute work. And he said, Marvin, come and look at this. And he showed me footage, CCT footage, however he got it, of a journalist friend of his. And real violence is horrific to see, being beaten to a pulp and put into a coma by two guys on the street. And that was his friend and colleague. And so I think he was fully aware of the level of threat that he was being exposed to by what he was doing and what he'd be exposed to by going back.
Martin, what do you make of Marvin Rees's defence of Alexei Navalny there, and also this sudden death of him? I think he's in his 50s, as far as I remember. I can check that now, but just literally on the first day of the Munich Security Conference.
Well, I've only just saw online that he died earlier this afternoon. So, we need more detail about what's actually happened. I think what this step represents is Navalny is regarded within Russia as essentially a stooge of Western interests. That's how the majority of population regard it.
Well, he's been put forward, hasn't he, as an opposition leader. Now, I don't know.
But whenever he stood in elections, he's got a relatively low level of votes. The real opposition in Russia is the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. They are the main opposition to United Russia. And at one stage, Navalny was pushing this idea that people should vote for anybody who could keep out Putin's United Russia Party. And so eventually he was plugging the Communist Party as the alternative, because they are the main alternative. But from the problem for Westerners like the Marvin Rees and others is that the Communist Party of the Russian Federation is even harder line on Ukraine than United Russia. And Navalny's position on Ukraine is, he said, well, that Crimea can be independent of Ukraine, but they have to have a proper referendum. And they said they've already had proper referendums. So his position was very marginal within mainstream Russian politics. And of course, he also did have major health issues, which is what the Russians said when they checked him over after he was supposedly poisoned. You can see what the West will make a big deal out of this, and they will say that it was, the Russians have killed him and so on. They won't say that if Julian Assange dies in prison in America. That will just be what he deserves. I don't think we should be welcoming the fact that he's dead. It gives another stick to beat the Russians with in the West. But people are totally deluded if they think that he represents mainstream Russian opinion, because he doesn't. He would be regarded as sort of the Russian Russell Brand. That's how.
Yeah, but what do you make of our mayor weighing in on this one?
Well, he does know him personally. I would argue that Marvin Rees probably knows virtually nothing about Russian politics, in my view. The murders in the Maidan Square, in 2014, that squad that carried out those assassinations of 80 plus people was a NATO squad. It wasn't a Russian squad. They came from Georgia. We've had a court case in Kyiv where all of this came out and the Berkut riot police were vindicated. And there's been massive investigations by Canadian academic Chechenovsky, I think he's called, who's actually Ukrainian, into what happened there. I'll bet you that Marvin Rees does not know anything at all about that. Nothing. And of course, what you've got at that Yale course that he was on is that's where the Americans get all the best and brightest.
Excuse me, CIA?
Well, it's not CIA.
Well, it is. Yes, it is. These are the deep. This is the deep state tapping people up to be global leaders. Some of those global leaders of tomorrow.
But don't forget, that's the way the US system works.
This is a fascist system.
They get people from all over the world.
Let's just be clear. This is part of what we were talking about earlier, undermining of democracy, where leaders are chosen by, in this case, by Yale University or the people who are funding it, the Yale World Fellowships. And that's how leaders are chosen, like our mayor. I mean, if you remember, Martin, back in February 2021, 3 years ago, we had Marvin endorsing Navalny, and literally the next day, Amnesty International renounced his status as a prisoner of conscience because they reviewed the statements that Navalny had made about Slavs being cockroaches and this kind of thing. Yeah, it was. It was Slavs.
No, not Slavs. It was actually about Caucasian people being cockroaches.
No, I think it was Slavs. Anyway, and let's not argue about that. No, but the fact is, he used this terminology to describe people, and Amnesty. It's not just that. There were various other occasions where he was extremely racist.
Very flaky views.
Extremely racist, and so in those cases. Amnesty said, well, hang on, this guy, we can't have him as a prisoner of conscience. He doesn't fulfil the criteria. What do you make of how this is going to play out in Munich anyway? Because this is going to be the talk of the town. Alexei Navalny's wife is over there now.
Well, I mean, it's the propagandists in the West will play this for all it's worth. But, of course, the fundamental problem they've got, and they're meeting in Munich to decide what to do, is that the war has been lost. They've lost the war, and they don't know what to do about it. And Navalny's death is neither here nor there in relation to the fundamental problem they face, which is that they've spent billions of pounds, billions of dollars, and the whole generation of young Ukrainians has been killed, and it's all for nothing, as it was always going to be all for nothing. A peace deal was possible at the beginning of the crisis, and they turned their noses up at it. Now, Russians are going to get everything they want. They said they wanted the Russian-speaking parts of the Ukraine, and there's absolutely nothing the West can do about it. And, there is going to be a presidential election in Russia in March, and I'm telling you right now that the fate of Navalny will not play any role in how people cast their votes. They're probably going to vote overwhelmingly for the current government because they trust them, and they don't trust people like Navalny at all.
Okay, so let me just take you back to last week, to Joe Banks and his report about the St Mary LaPorte development right in the Bristol city centre. The fact of the matter is that this is the centre of the city. Brigstow is the place by the bridge. This is the place. This crossroads where Bristol started over 1,000 years ago. And this hideous development that these people want to do, Federated Hermes, which is BlackRock and Vanguard, we had published in the Bristol Post just literally a day or so after this interview last week with Joe. And his article and his book about it, well, he jokingly refers to it as a book. I think he said it's 60,000 or 70,000 words, looking at how this development has and played out. We hear this week, Martin, that the biggest eyesore buildings will not be demolished until later this year. Well, the eyesore that's going to replace them as well. But at the moment, there's just kind of graffiti on these old buildings on the western edge, the northwestern edge of Castle Park, in the city centre here, next to Bristol Bridge. So developers have been given permission 18 months ago, but nothing has happened since. And the Bristol Post has published Information from the PR company for the developers, saying that there will be nothing going on the site where it was believed to be at any time now, this month. Nothing will happen there until the summer.
Well, I mean, it's a further development of the story, isn't it?
Well, I know, but it's also an economic thing. Maybe they've looked at this and saying, well, there's loads of money going into this. We're hoping to get very high commercial rents, but actually we're in the middle of a recession. Maybe the numbers for the development don't stack up anymore.
Well, that may happen. I was going to say that last week when we were debating all of this. If we do have a major crash, what's happening at the moment is stagnation rather than a crash. But, of course, that can become a crash because these things feed on themselves. As demand drains out of the economy, certain businesses and business projects become unviable. And, of course, the overvaluation of commercial property in this country is enormous. And at some point that could just crash, in which case what happens often is you're halfway through building something and you just have to stop.
Well, at the moment, they're not even starting until the summer at the earliest.
Maybe, as you suggest, that they're starting to wonder whether the numbers stack up. Because, of course, when the property market is rising, it's always easy to make money in it. But when it's not, it's more, it can catastrophically slump, as we've seen several times in my lifetime. Mm.
Well, I suppose if Rishi Sunak, as Prime Minister, presides over all this and the swivel-eyed Jeremy Hunt by his side completely fails to do the right thing, and we are entering a recession. It seems to me lots of this has been led by the high interest rates and by the high fuel prices, as Isaac was referring to there, has just made it impossible. I mean, this is almost like a rentier economy now, isn't it, where we're in.
That's what's happened.
Yeah,
we are a renter.
So because they can put the price of the
because
they can put the price of money, borrowing money up, and they can put the price of fuel up. I mean, we were hearing about the allotments, weren't we? The rents going up on there because they can do these things. This means everything becomes less viable. But staying on this planning story, literally a few minutes ago, at 4:30 this afternoon, published on the Bristol Post, government threatens, and maybe Joe's played a part in this, government threatens Bristol Council with planning takeover if it doesn't improve. The backlog of undecided planning applications is so big, the government has now intervened. So central government has written to Bristol City Council telling them that the city's planning service is failing, and if it doesn't improve, Whitehall civil servants will take charge in deciding planning applications in Bristol instead. A senior civil servant at the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities has written a letter to Bristol City Council informing chiefs that the council is failing to properly undertake its duty as the planning authority for Bristol, and included a threat to designate it, which means it would be put into the equivalent of special measures. Interesting, Martin, isn't it? We've been covering this over the last few months, and it looks like the government's finally woken up and said, well, actually, Bristol planning is broken.
Well, it may well be, of course, that the central government might take a much more liberal attitude to planning developments than Bristol City Council. So it's not necessarily a positive development if they say they're going to take it over. I think the fact is that we're talking about arguing about having a committee system or a mayoral system or whatever. Local councils are virtually bust. Bristol City Council has overspent £37 million, I think it is, on the special needs budget. We're arguing about how to make local authorities more democratic. They haven't got any flipping resources. They can't even do the basic stuff.
Well, what's been happening with planning, Martin, what's been happening with planning, as we were hearing last week, is the professional planners have been being sidelined, actually. Although they're sitting there, we were hearing from Joe last week that in the planning application for this hideous development in St Mary Le Port, and if you have a look at it, you'll see why I say hideous, folks. I put a picture of it up on the show page last week. The whole point of it, having it there is questionable, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, of course, what the point of starving local authorities of resources, because most of them traditionally, much of the resources came from central government, And if you starve them, they then force the local authorities to try and find money from somewhere, and saying yes to developers, you know, increasing allotment charges and all the rest of it. And it means that developers have got dealing with very weak councils. The council's position is weak when they're dealing with them because they've been undermined over many years. So that, you know, the council will say, well, if we just say yes to this development, then we'll get the business rate on this, and that will be for some resources to do the things we want to do. But of course, they shouldn't be having to do that. They should be able to have their adequate resources, perhaps by getting rid of council tax and bringing back the rates, including the business rate. You know, this is the sort of thing that a Labour government should certainly be thinking of doing, is we've got to reform the financing of local government, because it's been messed up completely by the poll tax and then subsequently...
Well, I mean, Bristol apparently is the worst in the country on planning, with something like...
Well, that's what central government says.
No, this is just facts, Martin, I'm sorry. I know you love to, defend Labour Bristol, but there are 1,700, by far the greatest in the country, outstanding planning applications that haven't been dealt with. It does seem to me that by paring back the planning system, that the mayor has managed to ensure that big developments are approved, but for small citizens are paying their council tax, the planning system is just literally a logjam for them.
Yes. But I don't think taking it central government will, the planning system is in this country is geared towards big developers. It's because that's the way we've always done it. And it's a kind of laissez-faire system where, as long as there's not a reason not to do it, then they're allowed to go ahead. And I think obviously what we really need is a much bigger input from democratic institutions rather than private companies, but that's a revolution and we're not going to do that anytime soon, are we?
Well, no, but surely this, you seem to be completely ignoring the fact that Bristol's planning, we have seen over the last few months on this show, we've been covering it quite a lot, that the priorities and the professionalism is absolutely horrendous. In fact, what's happened is, as I was saying last week, we're discussing with Joe, is that the professional planners have been slowly elbowed out through this process. So they've managed to get this planning application approved for the St Mary Le Port development. But in the process of that, the various people who stood up against it, saying this is totally inappropriate, etc., have been elbowed out. So what you've got is you've got a bunch of mates of the mayor now in those planning roles who are making these decisions. So it's hardly surprising that the system isn't working properly and the government is saying, well, look, this is just no good. There will be many developers across the city, some of them very small, complaining to the government, saying, look, they're just not doing their job here. And you can't say that's not happening. It most definitely is. So it's surely a good thing to get the government, central government, Tory or otherwise, actually this is really civil servants doing this, get them to pull their socks up.
Well, I think the proof of the pudding will be in the eating on that one, Tony. Liverpool's in special measures at the moment, so it doesn't really matter who votes for anybody in Liverpool. The central government's going to decide everything. And this show has quite a lot of emphasis upon local politics and local decision-making and all the rest of it. Yeah. Once you're in special measures with the central government, it's irrelevant what people locally think. They won't get a say.
Let's get back to Ukraine, one of your favourite topics, I know, and you quite often steer the conversation towards Ukraine, Martin, which is absolutely fine. And, of course, when we're talking about Alexei Navalny, that was exactly what you were doing, and, of course, you should have done. But we had some developments this week with a place called Avkiova, I think it's called. Do you know about that?
Well, I mean, it's an ongoing battle in Advika, I think it's called. I can't remember how to pronounce it.
Avklevka.
Yes, you've got it in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's one of these cities.
So let's have a listen to a news report and then you can say your piece.
Okay.
Ukraine's military says it's withdrawing from parts of the embattled eastern town of Avdiivka. Officials say supplying troops has become complicated. Russian forces recently cut off a major supply road and have been making gains. Moscow sees the town as key to securing full control of the Ukrainian provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk. Our special correspondent Andrew Harding has this report from Avdiivka.
The boom of Russian artillery near the ruins of Avdiivka. The Kremlin's forces have almost completely encircled the town after months of intense fighting. Ukrainian troops in the nearby hills told us they're now struggling because of a desperate shortage of ammunition.
So these are the last two shells that you have?
Yes, said a Ukrainian artillery officer called Alexei, explaining that his team used to fire about 80 shells a day at Russian positions, but Western supplies have now dried up. In a nearby village, two soldiers with shrapnel wounds arrived at a small field hospital. As he was being treated, 48-year-old Vadim repeated the same frustration about a lack of Western weapons. We just don't have enough, he said. I wish American politicians could come here just once to see the blood and sweat required to build a peaceful world. Avdiivka is just one of many towns the Russians are looking to seize here in the east. Ukrainian troops, having failed to capture much territory in their own counter-offensive last year, are now digging in for what could be months of defensive combat.
Avdiivka is the Kremlin. I think you got that right, Martin. But the point here is that this is going on at the Munich Security Conference. This is bad news for the NATO allies sitting there cooking up their next war with the Russians. You know, do you sort of think, well, actually Munich was the headquarters of the Pan-European movement where it was founded. It's also the headquarters of the Nazi Party for many years. That's where the Nazi Party was founded. Still, it's almost like they're sending out a message from Munich is we hate Russia, and they're carrying on even today. What the Russians have done is they've almost surrounded Avdiivka, haven't they? Which is quite an interesting tactic that they're using. It's not as if they're trying to cut them off and kill everybody. They're saying, well, look, you can still go out, but if you start sending any ammunition or men in, we're going to pop them off on the way in. So this is a way out that you can retreat, but you can't resupply.
Well, they've even actually called on them to surrender, but they've been ignored by apparently some people are making it through to the Russian lines to surrender. They were said 50 people had surrendered in the last 24 hours, all of whom were frostbitten.
The point I'm trying to make is about this Russian tactic of when they surround a city, there's always they're leaving a way out for people, which is an interesting tactic. It shows you
it's a change from the Second World War.
Yeah, it's not just
cauldron battles.
What I'm saying is it's not just a slugfest there. What they're doing is they're saying you can leave. You know, we're having this territory.
No, actually, what I think is happening is they've adapted because of drone technology to what is essentially attritional warfare, very, very unlike World War II. It's more like World War I. And what you're really doing is you're just grinding the other side down. And, of course, it's really foolish of the Ukrainians to keep on attacking in those circumstances. They'll have a better chance on the defensive than they had on the offensive. But it's still, they've used all of their, you know, they've basically lost most of their viable units, and they haven't got enough material.
Have you any idea of the casualties in this war so far? Like 2 years it's been going?
There's obviously been various, I follow Simplicius is probably the most detailed commentator on all of this, and Martianov and Larry Johnson, not Scott Ritter. I think it's clear from the relatively objective stuff is that it's been a disaster for the Ukrainians, and the Russians have had their casualties, and they've taken them with regret. But the Ukrainians have been decimated completely. Not least, and I'd just like to make this point: we were told when the Russians intervened in 2022 that the Ukrainians had no desire to attack the Russians, and that this was an unprovoked attack by the Russians on the Ukraine. And then this year or last year, the Ukrainians are attacking the areas controlled by the Russians. Now, do they want peace on that? And then we got to Merkel and Hollande both saying that the Minsk agreements were a fraud and that we pretended to negotiate with the Russians, but in actual fact, we always intended to retake all of the territory, including the Crimea, which had broken away from the Ukraine. So the whole basis of Western policy has been that the Russians have been belligerent and aggressive and we had no intentions of attacking them. And it turns out, yes, we do have intentions of attacking them. We even go on about how wonderful it is that we're attacking them. But of course, it turned out to be a military disaster for obvious reasons. They've been throwing themselves at the Sorovkin line, and they've been absolutely hammered to bits.
Oh, wait, one of the most interesting things that's come out of the last week's Tucker Carlson interview. I didn't play this clip last week. It was on the full length part of the interview on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Was the section where Vladimir Putin discussed Boris Johnson's role in scuppering the peace agreement in April 2022. He actually scuppered it in Kiev, but the agreement had nearly been signed in Istanbul, according to Putin. So let's have a listen to that section now. And actually afterwards, we've got a reply to it from Boris Johnson.
Do you think Zelensky has the freedom to negotiate a settlement to this conflict?
I don't know the details. Of course, it's difficult for me to judge. But I believe he has, in any case, he used to have. His father fought against the fascists, Nazis, during World War II. I once talked to him about this. I said, Volodya, what are you doing? Why are you supporting neo-Nazis in Ukraine today, while your father fought against fascism? He was a frontline soldier. I will not tell you what he answered. This is a separate topic, and I think it's incorrect for me to do so. But as to the freedom of choice, why not? He came to power on the expectations of Ukrainian people that he would lead Ukraine to peace. He talked about this. It was thanks to this that he won the elections overwhelmingly. But then, when he came to power, in my opinion, he realized two things. Firstly, it is better not to clash with neo-Nazis and nationalists, because they are aggressive and very active. You can expect anything from them. And secondly, the US-led West supports them and will always support those who antagonize with Russia. It is beneficial and safe. So he took the relevant position despite promising his people to end the war in Ukraine. He deceived his voters.
But do you think at this point, as of February 2024, he has the latitude, the freedom to speak with you or your government directly about putting an end to this, which clearly isn't helping his country or the world? Can he do that, do you think?
Why not? He considers himself head of state. He won the elections. Although we believe in Russia that the coup d'etat is the primary source of power for everything that happened after 2014. And in this sense, even today, government is flawed. But he considers himself the president, and he is recognized by the United States, all of Europe, and practically the rest of the world in such a capacity. Why not? He can. We negotiated with Ukraine in Istanbul. We agreed. He was aware of this. Moreover, the negotiation group leader, Mr. Arakhamiya is his last name, I believe still heads the faction of the ruling party, the party of the president in the Rada. He still heads the presidential faction in the Rada, the country's parliament. He still sits there. He even put his preliminary signature on the document I am telling you about. But then he publicly stated to the whole world, we were ready to sign this document, but Mr. Johnson, then the Prime Minister of Great Britain, came and dissuaded us from doing this, saying it was better to fight Russia. They would give everything needed for us to return what was lost during the clashes with Russia. And we agreed with this proposal. Look, his statement has been published. He said it publicly. Can they return to this or not? The question is, do they want it or not? Further on, President of Ukraine issued a decree prohibiting negotiations with us. Let him cancel that decree. And that's it. We have never refused negotiations, indeed. We hear all the time, is Russia ready? Yes, we have not refused. It was them who publicly refused. Well, let him cancel his decree and enter into negotiations. We have never refused. And the fact that they obeyed the demand or persuasion of Mr. Johnson, the former Prime Minister of Great Britain, seems ridiculous and very sad to me. Because, as Mr. Arakamiya put it, we could have stopped those hostilities with war a year and a half ago already. But the British persuaded us and we refused this. Where is Mr. Johnson now? And the war continues.
That's a good question. Where do you think he is and why did he do that?
Hell knows. I don't understand it myself. There was a general starting point. For some reason, everyone had the illusion that Russia could be defeated on the battlefield. Because of arrogance, because of a pure heart, but not because of a great mind.
So, Martin, what do you make of that description of the Boris Johnson? I'm almost like, you know what's in the back of my mind here is LaRouche. You know, the LaRouche Public Affairs Committee, they're a US think tank, and they say, well, everyone blames America for all these wars, etc. Actually, it's the British who are quietly at the centre of things, and this action by Boris Johnson, who was Prime Minister at the time, scuppering the peace deal between the Russians and the Ukrainians, does indicate that maybe the British role is particularly pernicious.
I think the British role is particularly pernicious, but we can't, and that's how the perception, that's perceived by the Russians. A lot of these terrorist attacks inside Russia, they think are being orchestrated by our special forces. But there's no way that any Prime Minister of Britain would be encouraging the Ukrainians to fight without the Americans having cleared it first. So, you know, he was the errand boy. Now, what should have happened, of course, is somebody like Robin Cook should have gone to Kiev and told them, you sign that piece of paper right now, because we're not going to back you. You've got to sort this out, bang heads together. That's what the role of a British Prime Minister, in my view, should have been. But of course, Boris Johnson personally has got the blood of all of these young Ukrainian men on his hands. And I hope it goes with him to his grave.
Well, maybe he doesn't care.
Or maybe he doesn't care. But as my grandmother famously said, he used to say, don't care was made to care. Don't care was on.
There is also something that Putin is hinting at right at the end of that clip, suggesting that actually there's a tremendous amount of blindness and narcissism here by our leaders.
Well, you think, Tony? Blindness and narcissism? I mean, that is Boris Johnson to a T, isn't it? And it's the fecklessness of it all that draw, you know, what an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars that a feckless imbecile like him has made this war, unnecessary war, continue far longer than it needed to do, with millions of people's lives ruined. He's at some point there may be some justice for this, either in this world or the next. But I think it's probably the most of all the things that Johnson has done. It's the thing that's least to his.
Well,
credit.
Surely the fact is that Boris doesn't believe in the next, and so he thinks I can get away with it.
No,
this.
He's a Catholic, Tony. He's a Catholic.
No, I don't think so.
He had to convert to Catholicism. To marry...
The one who was a big fan of Aleister Crowley, yeah. Look, I mean, I think, you know, by their actions, by their fruits shall you know them. And the idea that Boris is a Catholic or that Bush and Blair are Christians is rather laughable. Of course, they say these things, but in their actions is how you determine whether they are or not. So, anyway,
well, we could argue
let's have a listen to Boris's reply, which came out just after the that interview with Putin was released by Tucker Carlson last weekend.
Around the world, people are watching that ludicrous interview with Vladimir Putin conducted by Tucker Carlson, and we must not fall for this tissue of lies, above all, for the notion that Putin is somehow fated to succeed in Ukraine. On the contrary, he is doomed to fail. Read about it in the Daily Mail.
Read about how the Ukrainians are going to win. We will win. We will win in the Daily Mail. But anyway, that's
he's
Boris.
Going to get paid. By the way, he's going to get paid handsomely by the Daily Mail for writing those articles. And, of course, what military experience has Boris Johnson got? And the answer is none whatsoever. He has never, ever heard a shot fired in anger. He knows nothing about any of it. Nevertheless, he thinks he's Napoleon. But that's a sign of insanity, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's just avarice. I don't think any of this. I think it's too easy just to call people like Hitler insane. They weren't. They were avaricious.
I'm not calling Hitler insane. Boris Johnson is full of avarice. He is, but he's also full of arrogance and hubris.
Yeah.
He can write in the Daily Mail that Ukraine's going to win the war, but Ukraine's already lost. It's like it's a defiance of reality. It's just. You know, and of course, he's fully behind the Israeli massacre in Gaza because they've got a right to defend themselves.
So, what is the relationship like between UK and Russia? I thought it was fascinating. I think it was Sky News did an interview with Andrei Kelin, who's the Russian ambassador to London to the UK. He was asked about it on Sky. I'll put the link up to the full interview on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here's Andrei Kelin answering questions about what is the relationship actually like between Britain and Russia.
What are relations like now with Rishi Sunak?
We have no relations with Rishi Sunak, given that every day he's nearly insulting our president, of the government, and all that stuff. So we have no political relations with UK. We have contacts on the level of embassies and ambassadors, which is absolutely important. Your new ambassador has gone recently to Moscow. He has beat his credentials. Actually, this is like that. There's a rupture in economical relations. The trade between two states are now 96% down than it was before 22. We have no cultural programs, no scientific programs. Before the events, we have had a scientific program which has had about 200 points in it in the foreign exchanges.
And now it's dead in the water.
We have nothing.
Well, British and other NATO generals and ministers are warning of a threat of a large-scale conflict with Russia in the next few years. What's the view from Moscow?
They like it very much. They like to press it. I will tell once again that there are two things in it. One thing is to show to us that if we will continue fight Ukraine, then we will have to meet NATO. This is one. It's a threat. Second is that, of course, generals are trying to get more money from the budget for the reforms for the forces, especially in UK. I will tell you what President Putin has said in his interview to Tucker Carlson recently. We have nothing, no interest in Poland. We have no interest in Latvia. Estonia,
I mean, those countries are concerned that Russia is going to test Article 5 in the next few years.
They can imagine to themselves whatever they can, but the answer was absolutely straightforward, that we have no interest. We are not
again,
eager.
You
we
also said interested. There was no interest in the invasion of Ukraine.
No interest because, there is no interest in Poland or other Baltic countries, and we fully understand that any escalation beyond Ukraine will bring a world conflict, where a destruction of everything. So we fully understand that, and we cannot support this.
Well, Donald Trump has encouraged Russia to invade any NATO ally that's not paying a minimum of 2% of its GDP on defense. Do you think President Putin is tempted by this?
I think it's a joke by Donald Trump. It's of course very unrealistic. We will see what he's going to say if he will continue his campaign. I have seen a reaction to this statement today of different leaders. They are shocked and scared, I will say, and they say that they should increase their efforts to defend themselves and if U.S. will really withdraw from NATO or do it. So they are shocked and they are totally unexpected.
But how does Moscow react and respond?
We have no reaction. It is a statement during election campaign, a statement by one of the candidates. It is still unclear whether this candidate will be able to continue his campaign given the different legal processes that are going on in the United States. We simply do not comment like this.
I suppose it's tempting as a tribal person to be sort of saying, oh, well, our tribe is stronger than your tribe. Actually, he sounds very measured, very sensible. Andrei Kellen, that's the Russian ambassador there. Martin, it does sound as if this is a pre-war situation we're in now. No relations at all.
Well, it's not even a pre-war situation. We're in a war situation, effectively. It's just a very controlled war situation. But, of course, you know, the idea that this is all driven by evil Dr. Putin's desire to conquer foreign countries is just Western self. You know, there is no evidence whatsoever. What would the Russians want in Poland?
Well, as he says, there's five waves of NATO expansion eastward, not westward.
That's right. That's perceived in Russia as a threat to them. Which is why
Are they right to be afraid of Ukraine?
They are. Well, not of Ukraine. What's happened in Ukraine is that, just as in Afghanistan, the Western deep state drew Russia into a conflict which they hoped they could use to bleed Russia out and to overthrow the regime. But far from that happening, Putin is going to win the election next month in Russia. They've won the war in Ukraine, effectively. It's mopping up operations from now on. And they've lost a lot of their foreign reserves, which have been seized in the West. But they've made up from that by seizing the Western assets in Russia. And Russia is getting stronger. Their economy isn't in recession, Tony. Isn't in recession at all. Ours is the one in recession.
Well, we have inflicted that. We've inflicted that.
There's a shortage of labour in Russia.
We've inflicted that upon ourselves, hoisted by our own petard, or by Rishi Sunak's own petard, when he's Chancellor and also as Prime Minister. Anyway, what about Kellen? I find him an interesting little chap. He's quite, you know, sort of almost looks like a kind of shy guy. He's certainly not, you know, got the Mandelson Prince of Darkness demeanour. But he also talks about Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, the former US president, says he'll end the war between Ukraine and Russia in 24 hours. Do you believe him?
It is difficult to predict in the first place who will be in the White House in January next year. So it is nearly a year from now. What's going to happen during this year also, it is absolutely unknown.
But you would rather Donald Trump in the White House?
No, we do not say neither yes or no, because otherwise we will be immediately accused that we are supporting this president or that candidate. No, so we do not say about that. But what I will say, and what is important to understand, that at least Donald Trump is saying something about the end of the war, because all other including Rishi Sunak, including the Chancellor of Germany, including the leadership of the European Union, they speak about continuation of war, continuation of supplying of weapons for Ukraine, continuation of supporting it financially. They would like that the soldiers in Ukraine continue to die.
Martin?
Well, that's right. I mean, you can see he's a diplomat. Obviously, he's not going to fall into the trap of saying we support Trump to be the president. And, of course, Putin said that he supported Biden to be the president, which, again,
she did ask him, will you be fixing the American elections like you did last time? You know, and of course,
it's a stupid kind of statement,
but
isn't it?
But it's sky for
treated,
you. You know?
Treated with the disdain it deserves. I mean, even if the Russians wanted to steer American elections, which is very doubtful. I mean, as Putin said before, it doesn't really matter who's in power. The deep state runs the United States.
It's the permanent.
And that's all we need to know.
The permanent
government.
Those
are the people we're really talking to. And when we've got the message through that you can't beat us and you need to leave us alone, then they'll go away and leave us alone.
Well, they won't. No, they won't. They'll still carry on attacking. They'll still carry on attacking because their whole modus operandi is based on propaganda and warfare. But anyway, she also asked him whether he thought it was the wrong thing to do going into Ukraine. Had you got his fingers a bit burnt?
You don't recognize that invading Ukraine was a mistake?
No, it was not. It was a necessary step, unfortunately, because we, during all that time, and I do not want to repeat myself, during all that time, since early 90s, we were saying that we need, early 90s, I'm telling you about reunification of Germany, we need peaceful state, undivided security for all, including Russia. In return, we have got five ways of enlargement of NATO, and promises to Ukraine and Georgia that they will be in NATO soon, accompanied by NATO bases on Ukrainian soil.
Ukraine as a sovereign state can't make that decision unilaterally?
Ukraine should take into account interests of the neighboring states, especially. And the interests, if we would have good relations with NATO, friendly relations, if we were certain that NATO will not be alien or adversarial to Russia, it will be a different situation. Unfortunately, it did not happen. We even we tried to establish a good relationship with NATO. I spent myself 10 years on that. We even, as President Putin has said recently, even asked for, can we be admitted to NATO? And it will be a resolution of the question for all. He asked Bill Clinton about that. Bill Clinton has said initially, why not, probably, but the same day in the evening, he said, no, it's against our interests. It will be against the interests of the United States because it will undercut domination of the United States.
But if Ukraine...
No, I'm saying that. That is why NATO, we cannot consider as only adversarial alliance. And of course, we are not able to allow our closest neighbor, which is inhabited by Russians, to enter the organization which is adversarial to us.
So that's the final clip from Andrei Kellin. Interesting him talking about Trump, but there, Martin, saying, actually, no, it was absolutely necessary, and we're rather pleased with the way the special operation's gone.
Well, I didn't hear that, but I mean, he just said we don't regret it. We had to do it. It's been a painful thing. And we don't, you know, nobody, we tried, you know, as we were discussing earlier, they tried to force a peace deal. Don't forget that before the special military operation began in 2022, the Ukrainians had refused to negotiate with the Russians at all. But as soon as the special military operation began, Zelensky picked up the phone to Putin and said, we need to talk. And Putin said, about time, let's do it. But up to that point, they hadn't talked, because they were being told by the West not to. But they did. And then they came up with a deal which would have satisfied everybody. I understand that the deal included the fact that the breakaway republics would remain part of the Ukraine but would get some autonomy within Ukraine. Crimea would obviously revert to Russia. It would have been quite a good deal from the Ukrainian point of view. But now, of course, the Russians are in a stronger position and they've annexed those oblasts. And they are now permanently going to be part of Russia. That was on the table for discussion, but it's not anymore. And, of course, the real question that people watching this closely are asking is, are the Russians, once they've ground down the Ukrainian army, are they going to move on the Odessa Oblast, which also has a large Russian-speaking population? And we'll have to see what happens with that. The West could negotiate. I mean, I think Putin, in a speech, you know, that he made with Tucker Carlson, was fairly clear. If you negotiate, the Russians want an end to the war. They're sick of it, as you can imagine. They don't want their young people dying in this war. They'd rather get on with doing something more constructive.
Well, I thought it was interesting the way Trump
offer.
I thought it was interesting the way that Trump was brought into the conversation, and one of the other people who is running for president is Bobby Kennedy Jr., RFK Jr., and he had this to say this week about the Joe Biden and whether he's really got a cognitive function.
I think the issue has been raised, and I don't think it's character assassination to challenge the president to come out and debate and to show the American public that he has the cognitive capacity to do this very, very difficult job. This is a job that requires a lot of complexity, a lot of nuance, a lot of very, very difficult decisions. This is the man who might get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning that your children and my children are depending on his answering it in a way that is, again, response to complexities. And we have a right, as the American people, I think, to know that our president is actually leading the country and somebody else is not. And, you know, there's so many special interests now in Washington, D.C., big financial interests that are trying to manipulate the political process. And I think those interests would just as soon have a president with cognitive deficits because it enlarges their power. I think it's really important for Americans to understand, for the president to show Americans with unscripted encounters with voters, but also through debate, that he actually is capable of handling this job.
As a quick follow-up, as president, if you were to determine that you couldn't remember significant chunks of your life, how would you address that?
Well, I would hope my family would say it's time to enjoy your retirement.
Time to enjoy your retirement, Joe. I mean, the most important point that Bobby Kennedy Jr. is making there, Martin, really, is that this guy ain't competent to do the job at all.
Well, I think that's widely perceived all over the world. I think from the Russian point of view, if we come back to the Russians, is they don't actually think that the presidents of the United States have very much power. They know that it's the advisors and the deep state, the generals, the Pentagon that decide things. And so that's why they're so relaxed about who it is, because it don't make any difference to them. And they obviously, you can see that the Russian system, with its, you know, its checks and balances, it's got semi-proportional elections, the presidential election takes place next month. If Putin didn't get 50% of the vote in the first round, there would be a second round. And then it'd be clear who has won, actually got most of the votes. And they've actually got a very, very competent civil service. The way they run the Foreign Office is that Lavrov is a civil servant. Nobody votes for Lavrov. He is a top civil servant expert on foreign affairs. Mm. People who run foreign affairs in the West are people like Liz Truss, who basically knows nothing about it. But she ends up being the foreign secretary. Now, our system is broken. Theirs has actually evolved into quite a useful piece of kit.
Well, it's not, Martin, it's not really, I mean, it has been broken, but surely, you know, things like King Charles putting, and Sunak putting Cameron in charge of foreign policy is just recycling previous war criminals into the job.
Well, it is. It's an old boys' club, isn't it? That's exactly what it is.
Well, they have an agenda,
don't they?
That's
exactly what's wrong
with it. They have a war agenda of some sort. Anyway, look, important events taking place next week. That is Tuesday and Wednesday at the High Court of Justice. A big rally starting at 8:30 in the morning, going on for both of the 2 days in support of Julian Assange's latest appeal hearings. What do you make of the significance, the wider significance of this, Martin?
Well, we all know that this is probably the most important human rights issue, certainly in this country and possibly globally at the moment. Because what it does is that the Western deep state has basically torn up the rule of law in order to get at Julian Assange. And they've openly admitted, Mike Pompeo openly admitted, we thought about assassinating him. This is the kind of gangsters they are. And, of course, you know, he has been, Navalny was sent to prison for fraud and for various other things, which may have been politically motivated, but at least there was a charge of doing something bad. What Assange has done used to be regarded as acceptable journalistic practice, as Seymour Hersh will
he certainly did. I mean, in the old days, it was actually people who were working for the security services. If they did the leaking, they would go to prison. We've just seen Joshua Schulte, I think his name is, has been sent to prison, I think, for 40 years. He's the guy that leaked the Vault 7 stuff, which is absolutely fascinating, folks. If you haven't had a review of that, talks about hacking vehicles of all sorts, including cars, aircraft, trains. This is the one you may remember. The headline was that it's your when your television is on standby, it's actually listening to everything that's going on in the room. Now, these were the, you know, up until that, I suppose, they would have been described as conspiracy theories. But WikiLeaks and Joshua let us know that actually this is exactly what. And in fact, one that Vault 7 published the manuals of all these software tools to do these things. So if you wanted to hack into somebody's TV or whatever, this is the tool you need to do it. I'm not sure if it's just sitting on your smartphone or your laptop or whatever, but the tools have been created and constructed to hack into just about everything on the planet that's on a smart mechanism to it. Yeah, very ironic calling it smart. But anyway, let's have a listen now to, and I spoke to him last night over in Australia, John Shipton, who's Julian's father, to explain what's going on in the courts next week.
Well, Julian has made an appeal to the High Court of the United Kingdom for an appeal hearing. He's asked for a hearing. The hearing on the 20th and the 21st will be before two judges who will decide in their leisure whether Julian can have a hearing an appeal hearing, whether he can have an appeal hearing and under what circumstances that appeal hearing may be heard if they give permission.
You mean they may not? And what happens then if they don't?
The appeal will go before the European Court of Human Rights.
I just wonder, I mean, you know, this is taking such and such a long time. Must have taken a terrible toll on Julian. Is it possible that the European Human Rights Court of Human Rights might find in his favour? Obviously, there is quite a lot of enmity between Westminster and Brussels.
Well, in the institutions of state hating each other, but they seem to hate Julian more than they hate each other.
Why is that?
I think if you take the act that was introduced into the United Kingdom, a legislation recently proposed as the digital safety, the urge to censor has grown over the period of Julian's persecution. The last 15 years has grown now to be something that the state urgently wants to institute. The destruction of the ideas of Julian Assange and the malicious incarceration in one form or another over 15 years and the 28 court cases have demonstrated to anybody in your position that's doing research journalism that the state will, if you find something that the state doesn't like, the state will pursue you with all the force that it can command.
You know what? It sounds a bit medieval, this.
To me, you know, the United Kingdom, a place that I loved to go to in the 70s, has declined into a medievalism, book burning medievalism. And in parallel with that, it's interesting that London was one of the world's great financial centres, and writing trillions of dollars of contracts which occasionally fall into dispute and need adjudication, and having a fair court, a fair law administration, enabled people, felt comfortable, and enabled people to sign contracts with some confidence that the if it fell into disrepute, it would be fairly adjudicated. Well, that's gone. You can only now understand that if the political circumstances favour one side or another in a dispute before the law courts of the United Kingdom, if the political circumstances so favour, then the decisions will be made in that direction. This is so destructive to the reputation of the country that brought to us at Rummy Mead the means whereby a shield is placed between the state, in that case the sovereign, and the people. Magna Carta, that great gift of the English-speaking people to administration, fair administration by the sovereign to the people through the relationship of law, has gone. They've thrown away their gold, and they've, if you might like the expression, they've killed the goose that laid the golden egg, and that golden egg was Magna Carta. Now the state uses law as an attack weapon against the populace.
And what do you make of what John's saying?
Well, I mean, I agree with all of that. It's a very significant case for the reasons that he's...
I mean, they keep saying this is the last chance, this is the last chance. John's saying it will actually go to the European Court of Human Rights, which, I mean, do you think there's any chance that they may do something? I know in Australia that they've been very loudly calling for his release.
Yeah, well, the European Court of Human Rights, of course, it's not part of the EU. It's a non-EU institution. And we're still part of it at the moment, although some Tory MPs don't want to be part of it. And I think it's quite likely that they may overrule the British courts on this. And eventually, you know, I mean, as you say, there's been a vote in the Australian Parliament calling for his release. You know, at some point, it may be that they'll just give up on trying to persecute him. Or they won't, in which case this will just go on and on and on as we slide towards the precipice of global war and all the consequences that will follow.
Yeah, I think the idea, of course, is to send a message to other journalists that this could happen to you. This is a very pernicious act, as John was describing, you know, basically tearing up the Magna Carta, tearing up this whole idea of, well, you cannot be in prison without due process. There's no due process here at all. This is just an authoritarian dictatorship.
Well, it is. And you know, I mean... You know, the real history of Britain is a lot less squeaky clean than some people like to think of it. But nevertheless, this is a significant, you know, they've got themselves in a position now where they've gone so far to persecute Julian Assange that if they release him, they look stupid. So they don't want to do that. And don't forget that the deep state really does hate him because of what he represents. And they're talking now about, you know, you saw the head of the British Army, Sanders, saying we're going to have to go to war with Russia and that's going to have consequences for the people. And we're going to have to organise everybody and, you know, there's going to have to be, you know, basically, we're going to have censorship. We're going to tell, you know, all these things.
I get the impression that they're talking themselves, talking this up. But I can't see that there is the will, the political will within Britain to fight such a war.
Well, there isn't, but the deep state feels that it wants them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, back in 1939, I think, you know, go back to 1939, the people realised that this guy Adolf Hitler was a bit of a Nazi, that he was very dangerous, and Winston Churchill was making speeches about the possible end of Christian civilization, this sort of thing. People did understand that Hitler was evil and something had to be done about him. Now I don't think that they've managed to get that momentum. So maybe this is all just a fear exercise.
Well, it is. I mean, they're beating the war drums and therefore they need to lean on dissent so that they can keep their, you know, their propaganda can be more successful.
I mean, it's not just here in Britain that this is all going on. John explained to me that there's loads of activism in Australia too.
On March the 9th in Sydney, there's a public forum that has speaking Alistair Crook, Craig Mockheber, this UN official that resigned at the beginning of our Al-Aqsa flood over the treatment of the Palestinians, Professor Joe Camilleri, Con Pavlakis, and for Benoit Campmark, Emma Sharp, all people who evaluate geopolitics and media relationships to use Julian's circumstances as an emblematic of a collapse into barbarity.
Yeah, barbarism. I mean, that's really what he's talking about. This is coming down from King Charles at the top.
King Charles probably wants Julian Assange in prison, I imagine, but he's hardly the main perpetrator of this.
So you think Sunak does? I mean, Charles does all the appointing of everybody, doesn't he? He appoints the army chiefs. He appoints the judges and the magistrates. I mean, he's appointing pretty much everybody. So, you know, this is where I'm afraid it's trickling down. As you and I both know, it's extremely likely that he had his wife murdered, Princess Diana, back in 1997, for example. So I think, you know, you can smile in front of the cameras as much as you want, but at the end of the day, like us, we were talking about something else earlier on, by their fruits shall you know them. He is the head of state. He is in that position of making these appointments. He's also an honorary, I'm not sure, is it not president, but something of the three intelligence services. So he's involved in appointing the leaders for those two. You know, this all comes back to King Charles, in my view.
Well, I think that's your view, I feel, is distorted. He's definitely part of the establishment, and no doubt he agrees with what other people in the establishment think. But he's not nearly as important as you suggest in these matters.
Well, I think he is. I mean, you look at the appointment of Cameron, for example. I think that was Sunak and Charles just having a lunch on Remembrance Sunday and saying, "Let's put this boy in charge. We rather like him."
Yeah, Sunak is the one who decides who goes in the cabinet. So even if
Sunak doesn't decide anything, Sunak is a gopher, Martin, as you know. He doesn't decide anything.
He's a gopher for Goldman Sachs, Tony. He's not a gopher for King Charles. I think this obsession with the personality of Charles.
It's the head of state. It's not an obsession. It's looking at the way power operates. He's now in the order of the garter. He's invited Tony Blair into there as well. So all these, you know, chivalric things, which is, you know, where narcissists congregate, this is where you'll find them.
Yes, and he's very much a part of that as King Charles. But he's not the main. I tell you who really runs this country, Tony. It's the CIA. Well, they run Britain.
They certainly have a role.
They don't have a role. They run it. And Mossad. They're the people behind the throne. You've got this obsession.
Martin, you have an obsession too. The head of state is the most powerful person in the country, actually. Never mind the CIA for a minute. They're doing all the appointments of ministers and all this sort of thing. So let's have a listen now to the poem of the week. This is about our wonderful mayor, Marvin Rees. Another poem from Patrizia Opulenza. Thanks very much, Patrizia. And of course, we've seen Marvin rather ill-advisedly applauding this guy, Alexei Navalny, who sadly died today. And also, of course, causing so much chaos that the government has got to step in and take over Bristol's failed planning system. Ode to Marvin, the bountiful ego. Marvin on a roll, seems, attending meetings now, off his schemes, of things to do, scrawled on a list, all gone to ground, a Fagin's twist, seen giving thanks to volunteers, their faces on his Twitter sphere, labour cheap, oh what a gas, behind their backs, perhaps a laugh, for cleaning up public spaces, see the pride on all their faces, while Marvin lives the life of high, street cleaners now, mere pie in sky. Why keep a dog and bark yourself? Marvin hopes this act of stealth be seen by all. This mayor, 'tis true, a life of Riley is living through, embedded with the WEF and those who seem our freedoms all oppose. A book, it is said, now in the making of Marvin's life while undertaking his role as mayor, his highs, his lows, his hopes, his fears, his ambition grows to become one of the jetting set. Yes, Marvin won't let trouble get in the way of what he strives for, fame and fortune, watch him vie for. Barton House won't go away. Tenants still all want their say. Marvin asked email to be sent to show he cared for this event. Grosvenor Hotel still stands in tatters, compulsory order. Does this matter? Will this become another scheme for Marvin and his high-rise dreams? Requiem, getting up to stuff. A statue built called Marvin's Bluff, destroying buildings with history. A hoodlum. In our midst, all see. Smooth talker, walker, photo ops. Yes, Marvin loves his fan base stops. Folk who need to look up to a so-called leader without a clue. His bounty full, Marvin marches on, hope in heart for all he longs. Not long left to make his mark on dodgy deals he did embark. His mugshot in the local papers at night, his face in mirror savours. No care what rot he leaves behind. Bristol soon be out of mind. Rubbing shoulders with heroes be the meeting where all Marvin see. A sycophant Rhys ever be. Ne'er-do-wells and celebrity. Narcissist, a man now free, of shackles bound, soon hopes can flee. From his roots to higher places, his book bestseller, Hopes Will Grace Us. Marvin and his fight to be loved by high society. So thank you very much once more, Patrizia, for your ode there. And we'll be back, hopefully, talking to Vanessa Bealey after the break.
Yeah! 1929, I owned a little farm, was doing just fine. Raised a little row crop, raised some wheat, and sold it over at the county seat. Drawed the money, raised a family. The dust come along and the price went down, and I didn't have the money when the bank come around. Tumbleweeds and the black dust blowed, so we hit the trail to where the waters flowed. Way out across yonder somewhere. Hot old rocks and the desert sand made mine run back to the Dust Bowl land. But my hopes as high as we rolled along to the Columbia River up in Washington. Lots of good rain, little piece of land, feller might grow some. We settled down on some cut over land and pulled up the brush and the stumps by hand. The sun burnt up on the first crop of wheat in the river down the canyon just 500 feet. Might as well have been 50 miles. Couldn't get no water. We loaded our belongings and lit out for town. Seen the old vacant houses and the farms all around. Folks are leaving out, and if you're asking me, that's just as lonesome a sight as a feller can see. Good land. Grow anything you plant if you can get the moisture. Struck a lumber town, heard the big saw sing, and when business is good, well, lumber's a king. Went to looking for a job, but the man said no, so we hit the skids on the old skid road, traipsing up and down, chasing a bite to eat. Kids hungry. Heard about a job, so we hit the wheat, made about enough for the kids to eat, picked in the berries and gathered in the fruit and the hops and the peaches and the apples, too. Slept in just about everything, except a good warm bed. Been to Arizona, been to California too. Found the people is plenty, but the jobs is few. Well, maybe it's just like the feller said, when there ain't enough work, or business is dead. Nor to ailing. Ain't no money changing hands. People changing places. Folks wasting gasoline chasing around. Now what we need is a great big dam to throw a lot of water out across that land. People could work and the stuff would grow, and you could wave goodbye to the old skid row. Find you a job. Work hard. Raise all kinds of stuff. Kids too.
Mama, look there, your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. Shooting for Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the day before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad, it was Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, a banner for the playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color, is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets won Castro dead. For Castro is the color. Ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet.
How many months did the Chinese get in a war-torn swamp? Stop any mercenary and check the British bullets in his armory.
Well, can you hear that little sound? That's the sound of Vanessa Beely. Well, she said she was going to be ready on the phone at 7 o'clock tonight. I hope nothing horrible's happened to her. But she has been being a bit sort of funny over the last few weeks. Sort of, you know, I've been trying to get her to do something. Reach is currently unavailable. There you go. That was Vanessa. So, no Vanessa Beely. Of course, actually, there was a... she was being very sexist on Facebook, and I said, well, are you sure it's a really good idea to have a go at men like this? It's sexist, isn't it? And so she unfriended me, and since then she's been being very weird. I've been trying to get Vanessa on for a few weeks, because obviously, you know, the massacre in Gaza should be more important than these sort of petty little differences, although I must admit, from years gone by, I remember documentary makers in the 1970s and 80s used to have feuds with each other, which just seems very silly. But I would have thought that she would understand that the genocide going on in Gaza is rather more important. And I wanted to ask her about Jordan particularly, and also about Qatar's role. So, you know what? Second best. Well, actually, maybe just as good. We will ask Martin Summers about that. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream, live on the Not the BCFM Politics app, available free from all good app stores. And Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is joining me too. I'm Tony Gosling. Martin, what do you make of the role, given that Vanessa has cried out, of these two countries, Jordan and Qatar, in the genocide?
Well, both countries are... Qatar is a monarchy without much local representation at all. Jordan is another monarchy which does have some pretensions to having a parliamentary democracy. And, of course, they've got a large number of people who are originally Palestinian origin in Jordan. So they're actually, you know, they were driven out by the Israelis in 1948, and they are in Jordan, although they're not from Jordan originally, and they are Jordanian citizens. Qatar, their role has been quite tricksy because they've got a US base in Qatar, so the US have got one of their major bases there. They're aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, which means that's why they've got the relationship with Hamas, which is also part of the Muslim Brotherhood family. This is why Qatar and Saudi Arabia don't really get on, because Saudis don't like the Muslim Brotherhood at all. They see them as a kind of rival and a threat. Qatar is a swing state. That is where Hamas leadership is now based, although the Qataris put Hamas up to joining in the rebellion against Assad. So they're not really very trustworthy. That's what I'd say about Qataris. The Jordanians.
Hang on, just a minute. You're very myopic on this sort of thing, Martin. I hope you don't mind me saying. But actually, Al Jazeera's coverage, which is owned and run by the Qatari royal family, has been fantastic.
Yes, and I think Qatar has got to be assessed as one of the, it's one of the factors in, this is the sort of thing that Vanessa no doubt would have been talking
better
about.
Better than China's, even.
Well, not necessarily.
Yes, it is. Far better. If you ever watched that Chinese...
Al Jazeera?
Yes. If you ever watched the Chinese stuff, it's pretty dry.
Al Jazeera has clearly made the English language 24-hour news cycle more, more diverse, and therefore it's to be welcomed. Mm. But, of course, they do have a political line, so Al Jazeera was pretty much behind the rebellion against Assad, for example. So everybody's entitled to their view.
Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera also reported that Gaddafi had been bombing his own people. But I mean, when it comes to Gaza, I get the idea that Al Jazeera is simply there to make sure that there is a hardening of the sides, as they call it, so that the anti-Israel view is very well distributed around the world in the media, and so people can tune in if they want to see these horrors that the Israelis are inflicting. And so they can choose sides. So people can say, and of course, when you have a war, everyone has to choose sides. That's part of the deal.
Yes, and I think Al Jazeera is a welcome addition to the different English language voices that people can hear. But you've got to be aware that they've got an axe to grind. They've got a perspective, just as Russia Today has, just as BBC World has.
Because I forgot to trail the music to back announce it. So we had Go Tell It on the Mountain. That was the Montreal Gospel Jubilation Choir. We then had Woody Guthrie with Washington Talking Blues. And finally, Washington Bullets with The Clash. Sorry to forgetting about that. I should just say that straight away. I just have to say I'm suffering a bit this week. You might be able to tell. With a bit of a cough. Some sort, but it's not COVID. I actually tested myself yesterday and it isn't COVID, but feeling grotty, and I was a few weeks ago as well, so it doesn't often happen that. Let's look a little bit wider around this whole business of the Middle East conflict, Martin. Is there anything you'd like to flag up? Because the Egyptians are now beginning to build a camp, aren't they, for the Palestinians?
They are. And I think that what's happening now, of course, is that even the British and the Americans are saying, well, perhaps you shouldn't attack Rafah. And of course, the Americans have said, well, there'll have to be a two-state solution at the end of it. And Netanyahu said, no, there won't. So we'll have to see how this develops. It's an incredibly dangerous situation and, of course, absolutely tragic for the people of Gaza. And I think, people will rightly see this as a very, very fundamental issue when it comes to the general election in this country. We've got to get people in power in this country who know how serious this issue is.
Well, I don't
is.
Think it's going to happen, is it? Because Starmer is not going to be like that. Anyway, look, this week on the BBC, they had a guy called Lieutenant, I think it was on the PM programme on Thursday, a guy called Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner from the Israeli Defence Force.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is a spokesperson for the IDF, the Israel Defence Forces, and joins us, and we appreciate you giving us the time. This phrase, precise and limited, is that the right description for what we've heard happening there at Nasser Hospital?
Good evening. Yes, indeed. The IDF is continuing its operations in Khan Yunis area, in western Khan Yunis. A hotbed, a center of gravity of Hamas, as we've seen throughout the course of the last 3 or 4 weeks now, Hamas has built and its fortifications, its establishment, its capabilities with whether it's the tunnels where Yahya Sinwar himself was hiding out at, or the vast, expansive tunnel system that they built in. And indeed, throughout the course of the operations, as we pushed forward, we noticed and identified, and also based on the intelligence that some of the hostages had revealed to us, we've seen that Hamas terrorists had indeed, perhaps also with Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorists, gone into the hospital and taken control of the premises. And
have you found anything today? Have you found any evidence of Hamas operatives there, or terrorists or hostages?
We announced earlier today that we had arrested and detained some suspects of that have been involved in the October 7th attack. So I would say yes, absolutely.
In the hospital, from the hospital.
From the hospital, yeah, from the hospital. And what it actually reflects is precisely what we've been saying throughout the course of this war. Hamas has weaponized the humanitarian and medical mission and subordinated it to its war effort. We found in all of the hospitals that we've been to, whether it's the Shifa Hospital, Rantisi Hospital, Al Amal Hospital, and Nasser Hospital just this morning, that Hamas has no problem putting its weapons there, its command control capabilities, communication capabilities.
Yeah, and I know there's been some argument about whether the tunnels represent a command and control facility or represent just tunnels, and I know that was at Al-Shifa, and there's been arguments over the interpretation of it, if you like, of what you've found. Can I ask you, Lieutenant Colonel, whether you accept civilians have died? Now, partly in air raids is one charge, air raids on the hospital, patients killed, or at least a patient killed in the hospital in an air raid, and through snipers outside the hospital as people have left.
I think it's important to weigh on the issue of the tunnels before I move on, and I will ask, will answer that. The tunnel system that Hamas has built, going beneath the hospitals, going beneath mosques, indeed putting their data center beneath the UNRWA headquarters, the United Nations' biggest organization in Gaza, are a strategic step. It gives them flexibility. It gives them the ability to mobilize. It gives them the ability to communicate. It gives them the ability to conduct their attacks. It gives them the capability also to hide and conceal hostages in these places. So I wouldn't belittle that and just say...
I'm not belittling it. There were descriptions of command and control centers, and the pictures came out more like tunnels, which didn't look like command and control centers.
Martin?
Well, I mean, it's just self-serving stuff by the Israelis, isn't it? And of course, if this is the BBC, what should be happening there? We should get spokespeople for Hamas.
Well, there were spokespeople from Hamas on before him, but I thought it was more interesting to hear his lies, really.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's fairly clear that they've targeted hospitals because they've got a genocidal mindset. And of course, they can't really separate Hamas from the population because the population voted for Hamas in 2006, and you know, they're probably still quite sympathetic to them, especially because the Israelis have been so bestial towards them. It's this could stop tomorrow if the US picked up the phone and said, "You're not going into Rafah." Now, they've kind of signaled that they don't really want them to go into Rafah, but when they do go in, as I think they will, the Americans will then be faced with a dilemma: are we going to tell them not to? Well, we're not going to do that.
I mean, isn't this an elaborate real estate grab under the cover of some sort of terrorist pretext?
It is, and it's also the idea of getting rid of an untermensch population. And of course, there's a gas field there to fight for, yeah, which is obviously going to be an issue. What was I going to say about this?
Well, look, while you're thinking about what you were going to say, why don't we have a listen to brave Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, obviously not learning anything from history, talking about this whole idea of civilians being killed at this hospital. And Evan Davis on PM does actually really press him quite hard. You know, there are civilians there. Did you kill them? Because we have evidence that you did.
In terms of civilian deaths today at Nasser Hospital, it's whether you accept that those deaths have occurred.
No, we've not conducted any strikes or an open fire in the hospital. We've announced and informed the hospital staff that they will be safe, the patients will be safe. Indeed, the reality is that Hamas has hijacked hospitals and held hostages.
Descriptions of a patient dying after an air raid, that's just a mistake. That's not true. You're denying that. You haven't had air raids on the hospital that might have killed a patient.
No, we did not conduct any airstrikes
There's been description of sniper activity outside, and there's been one case that has been described. Abu Al-Ola was sent into the hospital yesterday, handcuffed, to tell people to get out. He had been taken by Israeli forces and was used to go into the hospital to tell people to evacuate. And the charge, as made by a journalist who's inside the hospital, is he was then shot, having done his bit telling people to leave. He was then shot dead as he left himself. Do you know anything about that story? Can you corroborate that story?
I did see images circulating on social media personally, but as the IDF, I can't confirm that story whatsoever. I will say, though, that we are doing, and we have been putting in a huge effort over the last few days to evacuate civilians in the hospital premises.
And they say when they tried to go out, there were snipers firing either above their heads or in some cases at people.
No, we secured a humanitarian corridor out of the hospital. We've been in contact with the administrator of the hospital in order to evacuate them.
Would the doctors say, you told us there was a safe passage out, but when we tried to use it, we found it wasn't safe. We were approached with bulldozer and tank, and we were finding ourselves allowed out in ones and twos, and many of us had to come back in.
No, I'm not aware of that at all. I would say that over the last few days, we've been trying to evacuate the hospital to get people out of harm's way. It makes absolutely no sense that they would open fire to them. If we keep in mind that there are terrorists inside the hospital, Hamas terrorists, and videos that I've seen of armed terrorists inside the hospitals as well, maybe it was a crossfire. Maybe somebody shot from within the premises. I don't know. This is just speculation. But I know that the IDF has been putting a huge effort to evacuate people from the hospital in order to get them out of harm's way, to move them onto the Mawasi area or to Deir al-Balah areas where we are not operating, areas where people can be safer.
But we also know that tens of thousands of people have been killed in Gaza, on the best figures we have, and I don't think Israel is really disputing the scale of it. We also know that, and we can see why people will be absolutely terrified when they're told go out this way or go out that way, and then maybe see snipers or tanks and bulldozers approaching them.
War is a terrifying ordeal, and we are at war. And what we are doing is trying to evacuate people from harm's way while Hamas is commandeering hospitals to keep them in harm's way, preventing them from evacuating, preventing them in order to conceal their activities. And I would add to try and prevent us from operating against them in their strongholds that they've established in these hospitals. This is precisely the dilemma. By not operating, we would be giving them a free pass to set the new norm of terrorism in hospitals. Is that a standard that we want? I would say absolutely not.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner from the IDF, appreciate your time. Thank you for talking to us.
So, yes, turning hospitals into terrorist camps, Martin.
Well, it's just self-serving flim-flam, isn't it, really?
It's a good cover.
It is, but, I mean, the evidence is that they've been deliberately targeting hospitals because they want to, and they're not letting any food or water in. So, you know, when they say they care about the civilian population, that's what Ansar Allah demand is. Let food and water in, and then we will stop our blockade of your ships. But they're not doing it. And the other thing they could have done at the very beginning of the crisis, if they wanted to, is said to the civilian population in Gaza, you can come to Israel. Just cross into Israel, we will look after you, and then they could have isolated the population from the Hamas terrorists, so-called, in their tunnels.
I mean, is this...
But they didn't do that, because if they did that, they'd have to accept that the Palestinians, in fact, most of the Palestinians inside Gaza, they lived in the villages where these kibbutzim were attacked. Their parents are buried under those villages.
I mean, Martin, is the Gaza genocide or the Gaza war, however you want to describe it, a simple case of good and evil?
Well, I mean, all wars are evil in the sense that, you know, even if your cause is good, it's evil to kill people.
Was World War II, with Britain standing up to the Nazis World War II, was that evil?
If the cause was good, it was still an evil thing to do, to raise Dresden to nothing and kill all the people in it, wasn't it? I mean, even if it's justified,
well, surely your right of self-defense is not evil.
Well, I mean, this is the whole point. I mean, the way that Cameron and Starmer and Sunak are talking is Israel's right to self-defense. What about the Palestinians' right to self-defense? As we speak, there is no Hamas fighting inside Israel proper at all. They're just fighting for their own streets where they used to live. That's exactly how the British Army would have fought if there had been an invasion of Britain in World War II. And the Germans would probably have done pretty much what the Israelis are doing, as they did in Greece and Yugoslavia, where the whole population is made to pay the price for the resistance of the few. Well,
hang on a minute, because as Philippa Winkler pointed out, the international relations lecturer who was on here just before Christmas, I think around about Christmas time, I think it was the show before Christmas, wasn't it? Actually, the Israelis do not have the right to self-defence to the attack on October the 7th, because actually that is occupied territory. So they don't have. Right. They've occupied that territory.
Right.
So the Palestinians have every right to take that back. And the Israelis do not have a right to self-defense.
You could argue that they shouldn't have taken civilian hostages. But most of the hostages that are now still being held, and there's not that many of them left, are in fact military personnel. So they're not hostages, they're prisoners of war.
Anyway, tonight Joe Biden has been calling for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza, in his strongest words yet. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think what's happened is because of the sheer scale of the brutality, the wave of revulsion. And obviously, there's going to be another demonstration in London tomorrow. There'll be demonstrations all over the world. They're trying to sort of rein the Israelis in, but it's like a Frankenstein's monster. They're not going to be reined in because the right wing in Israel are firmly in the saddle. The population has been basically bamboozled into supporting all of this. And that's where this whole idea of it being a let it happen.
I'm looking at Gaza and thinking maybe this is very similar to what happened in Ukraine. So you've got many years or several years of building up of resentment, which eventually is unleashed in the Russian special military operation. The idea seems to me to be to create these tensions, and at some point in the future, in the Middle East, the Syrians. Maybe the Iraqis too, the Iranians, possibly the Turks, who knows? The Lebanese, Hezbollah, will really attack Israel and actually threaten its existence.
Well, Ilan Papp, who is an Israeli academic.
Yeah, Pape.
He's an Israeli academic who's really the top expert on ethnic cleansing in Israel-Palestine. He says that this is probably going to be the end of the Israeli state. And I think in the long run, it will be the economy is in ruins. If you are a young middle-class professional in Israel trying to think about bringing up a family, it ain't the place to do it. Not anymore. And there is no... If you keep, as I said, when we had the Israeli guy on some weeks ago, if you keep betting the farm, then eventually you're going to lose the farm. And the question of whether the state of Israel should be there at all is coming back onto the international agenda. And if they carry on behaving the way they are, it could be that they're going to lose their recognition as an independent state and in good standing with the United Nations. You know, there's no guarantee that you can have a state. You know, people can just say, well, we're not recognising you. And, of course, what's also significant, I remember what I was going to say, the Irish and the Spanish and the Belgians and the Slovenians have approached the EU, and Josep Borrell, who's the EU foreign affairs person, said there's no way you can bring humanitarianism with a ceasefire, and therefore we've got to stop supplying weapons to, you know, the EU, and the EU countries should stop supplying weapons. And, of course, what the French and the Irish are suggesting, well, we need sanctions on them. So, in other words, this whole question of whether there should be sanctions on Israel on military aid and on trade, yeah? Well, you know, they're saying we urgently need to look at what trade deals we've done with the Israelis. Now, there is all sorts of pressure that could be brought on the Israelis by the Western powers, and public opinion in certain countries is definitely in favour of doing that.
I mean, when I spoke to John Shipton last night, Julian Assange's father, and the full interview excellent, of course, he is, as ever, is up on, including a bit of William Blake's poetry. Will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. He had this to say about the, particularly about the United States and the Western powers, the dynamic that's driving them right now.
I see that as an administrative means of the United States advanced by Admiral Sobrowski about 30 years ago, that you reduce to incompetence the state institutions of any nation that you possibly can. In the case of the Great Britain or the United Kingdom, it's clear that the administrative capacity has of a sovereign nation has all but disappeared. This means that you rule by chaos, which the United States is enacting wherever it goes.
Well, that's an interesting take, isn't it? Just dismantling and destroying all these various administrative institutions in the sovereign countries, Martin.
Yeah, well, if you listen to Michael Hudson and Radhika Desai, their Geopolitical News Hour, this is the whole point, is you make the state incapable of defending the interests of the citizens, and then private interests clean up on the back of that. But we can see that this is not a war-winning strategy. The Russian nationalized arms industry is showing what you've got to do.
Yeah.
And we can't do that because we haven't got a nationalized arms industry. And even if we wanted one, it'd take 20 years to build it. And it's too late because the war's over and the Russians have won. What's going to happen in Israel is going to be horrendous for the Palestinians. That's what Ilan Papp says. It's going to be horrendous for the Palestinians for the next couple of years. But ultimately, they may win total victory, in the sense that the state of Israel will be eradicated. Now, that wasn't on the agenda before all this started, but it's coming onto the agenda. And World War III is going to be a big mess, and states will come into existence and states will go out of existence, as happened in the last two World Wars.
Well, John Shipton is Julian Assange's father. Lots going on around this hearing next week on Tuesday and Wednesday, starting at 8:30, gather outside the Royal Courts of Justice in central London. Drop the charges, says Amnesty, ahead of the key Julian Assange hearing. So the risk to publishers and investigative journalists around the world, that's us folks, hangs in the balance should Julian Assange be sent to the United States and prosecuted there. Global media freedoms will be on trial too. Now, that's not a Julian Assange campaigner, that's Amnesty International.
Yes, and they've been fairly cautious about taking a stand.
Yeah,
on
they
this,
have up till now. Yeah,
it's fairly clear that they've come to a view. Let's hope he is released. I mean, that would be the best result all round. You know, I mean, the United States and Britain.
I mean, they can't allow that. Surely, I mean, there's no way the British and the American authorities can allow that, because he would become a kind of celebrity, wouldn't he? That's the last thing they want.
Yes, he would. So the Navalny solution beckons. He dies in obscurity, not in obscurity, because if he died, did you see that? There's a Russian conceptual artist based in south of France who's got loads of very expensive artworks, including ones by Rembrandt and others. And he said that if Julian Assange dies in prison, these artworks will be destroyed by acid. And he's got loads of people to donate their artworks and so on. He's put some of his own artworks in there. And he says, this isn't, you know, this is to put pressure on the authorities.
I mean, isn't that cutting off your nose to spite your face?
Well, he said, we don't believe that he will die in prison because he ought to be released. But if he does die in prison, this is all,
Stella has said this week, his wife, that if Julian is sent to the United States, he will die in jail there. I did ask John about that, and if you listen to the news, see what he has to say about it. I mean, he finds that impossible to contemplate, really. Also, Martin, so another country the United States has started bombing. Used to get its proxy troops to do this kind of thing. Nowadays, the Americans have no shame at all. The United States has launched an airstrike in Somalia today, says two two al-Shabaab have been killed. The US signed a deal to build the new military bases for the Mogadishu-based government. The US military has announced on Wednesday it's launched an airstrike in Somalia against al-Shabaab and support of the US-backed Mogadishu-based government. US Africa Command, AFRICOM, said the strike was launched at the vicinity of Vak Dagal, D-A-B-E-L, Y-A-Q-D-A-B-E-L, in Jubala, Somalia's southernmost province. So the Americans are taking control of there too, aren't they?
Well, they're everywhere. I mean, they've got CENTCOM.
They're surrounding Iran.
Sorry?
Surrounding Iran.
Oh, yes. I mean, Iran's so wicked, putting their country so close to so many American bases, aren't they? And, of course, they're surrounding Iran for the Israelis. Yeah? The Iranians present no threat to the United States. It's half a world away. The threat is to the state of Israel and to U.S. hegemony over the Middle East and elsewhere. But they've reached the point now. I mean, the global South has completely seen through what they're up to. The ICJ ruling on genocide was supported by all the Muslim countries. Every single one supported that.
I mean, I find it interesting that we're hearing more and more about AFRICOM and CENTCOM. AFRICOM is based in Stuttgart, Germany, but it's a big US controlling the whole of Africa military operation. And CENTCOM is the Middle East, and that's based in MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. But it's a bit arrogant of the Americans, I put it to you, that they have divided the world up into these various areas, the various command centres, to just control that world, by that part of the world, by military force, including China, by the way, including China, including Russia.
Well, it's the desire for full spectrum.
If anyone has not seen it, it's called the Unified Command Structure, and they've basically got a map of the world and put little lines around each part of the world and said, right, this is being controlled by these military here. So we're hearing more about these sorts of things. A lot of this, of course, goes back to 9/11, and we're going to hear now from Matt Campbell, whose brother died, Jeff, died in the Twin Towers on 9/11 back in 2001. And I just think it's so important to support him. He's trying to get the British legal system, and again, it's a bit of an Assange-style attempt here to get the legal profession to do the right thing. And, you know, those judges appointed by King Charles, I know you don't think he's powerful at all, but I do. And let's have a listen now to Matt Campbell speaking to me last week about this decision by the Attorney General to deny him the right to reopen his brother's inquest. I mean, as he explains, there was no evidence much at all, and he's got some interesting new evidence he wants to put forward to reopen the legal process around his brother's death.
Firstly, it's very much just lawfare. They're trying to exhaust us time-wise, energy-wise, and obviously money, because these things aren't cheap. I mean, they've come back with, you know, citing reports which, you know, the US authorities made into the collapse of the towers, but these reports were not in front of the Attorney General. So, in front of the coroner. So they're almost irrelevant, referring to, you know, something that was published by a different body that wasn't actually even looked at by the coroner. There's also the situation where actually nothing in those reports by NIST, that's the National Institute of Standards and Technology, actually looks at the causation or what actually happened when the building collapsed, which is, you know, basically my brother died when those buildings were destroyed. So, you know, they're citing things that really have no relevance. They're also saying that none of our evidence and, you know, we have a fair bit. We have eyewitness statements. We have expert statements. They're saying none of that is credible. And yet in the same breath, they're saying that they're not going to carry out their own investigation using their own experts. So, I mean, they have a duty in law. If they're going to refuse something and say, refuse our request and cite that and our evidence is not credible, they have to give reasons. They can't just say it's not credible. And there's other strange things they have in there where they are unable to conceive what additional benefit Al-Qaeda or indeed any other malignant actor would gain by planting explosives, you know, to destroy the towers. I mean, you could argue, why just do one plane? Obviously, it was to create terror. It was to create as much terror as possible. Secondary explosives are commonplace in terrorist attacks. So this idea that they can't envisage a situation where the towers would want to be brought down, you know, also ignores the fact that if you're just looking strictly at what Al-Qaeda have done before, all those kind of operatives, you know, they tried to destroy the World Trade Center in 1993. And, you know, basically said, given a bit more money and explosives, they would have brought those towers down. I mean, there's other connections. I think there's the right-hand man of the blind sheikh, who was still trying to get hold of the World Trade Center blueprints as late as 1999. You know, it's just that there's no real reasons why they're refusing.
I'll put the full version of that interview with Matt Campbell up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and I hope you can have a look. Anyway, it's ic911.org. I think it's the legal site for all of the legal cases which are still trying to pursue the solution to the September the 11th legal attacks of various sorts. Martin, this is quite significant, isn't it, that Matt has decided to pursue this to the bitter end?
It is, but obviously, as he said, lawfare is still, you know, the name for it. And, you know, there is not really a rule of law. There's a pretense as a rule of law, and, you know, people pretend that it's actually, you know, there is some kind of, you know, recompense.
So what is going on? I mean, it's like Israel, and the pursuit of a third world war seems to mean that the powers that be in charge, you know, the King Charles's, the those in charge at the Department for Justice, the judges, etc., that what they do is they just ignore the rule of law in cases which are to do with Israel and pursuing a third world war.
Well, it's they are in fact criminals, and that in the sense that you know, if there was an independent police service, many of them would be already arrested. But there isn't, and they're not. And that doesn't mean that you can get rid of the concept of rule of law. It's a good concept. It just isn't put into practice, is it? Especially if you're powerful, you're able to use the law as a mechanism for silencing people you don't like. That's where we're at. But if people don't, you know, 'twas ever thus, if people don't stand up and defend their rights, they're taken off you. And, you know, that the slogan we have on these demonstrations, in our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians, is because if they're allowed to do that to the Palestinians, what are they going to do to everybody else? You can't walk by on the other side of the road. It's not really, you know, you've got to do something when these kind of things occur.
Well, you have to stand up, basically, and do something. This is, we're going to hear now from Jordan Durante, who contacted me before Christmas. He is pursuing the murder of his grandfather, as he explained, as he started to go through the courts to try and do this, to get something moving. He believes that there were attempts to kill him.
On my YouTube channel, you'll see on November the 8th, 2021, I've done a video to do with what happened to me on that night. The lawyers who represent the executor who failed to get a counsel or payment to my family in 35 years put an application in to stay my family's proceedings at 4:17, just before the court shuts. On that very evening, I was attacked by three people with knives. And at the same time, the police commissioner, Police Complaints Commissioner in the Isle of Jersey, Isle of Man, who is called Mr. Jeff Friend Karen, emails me at 10:26 at night and said now that they're taking the case very seriously and we're going to look into it. But previously, earlier that day, he said the case was shut. So I'm wondering why there was such a rush to put an application in to stay my family's proceedings on November the 8th, 2021. What happened to me later that evening, and that the Police Complaints Commissioner emailed 1 minute before people tried to stab me.
But that is interesting, isn't it? And what about some of the other incidents? Was that in the street?
Well, in Spain, I was living in Spain in poverty when I was fighting these people in the beginning. So people would put things in my drink. A couple of cars tried to run me over. And when I first went to the Isle of Man to try and trace down the executor, who I'd never met in my life or ever spoken to, I found his house. And when I walked back, a car tried to run me over.
So that's Jordan Durante. But why were these people trying to get rid of him, as he says? The reason is millions of pounds in trusts, which was supposed to go to him, never did when his grandfather was murdered.
What happened is, I've obviously got to look into my family's documents in 2019. And basically, after reading lots of different bits of information, there was one corporate provider, trust service provider, that is basically my trust service provider. And I read a newspaper article one day in The Guardian, and it happened to mention that name of that trust service provider. So I got in contact with that journalist, and basically he introduced me to a family who has the same trust service provider, and that family is Darren Dick Stock, and they shared documents with me. And I could clearly see that there was a fake repayment or a repayment from their American court case and those documents behind my grandfather's house where he was murdered. So I could immediately tell that the individuals in these documents are certainly involved in what I allege is a financially motivated murder of my grandfather. So I contacted the police whilst I was living in Spain. And for over 4.5 months to 5 months, the Metropolitan Police threatened to arrest me and said that my grandfather's murder did not exist. So I kept calling them and I was determined that I was going to fight this corruption and cover-ups. So I continued calling them, and one day the police officer came on the phone and said, "Jordan, how can we get you to stop calling us?" So I said, "All right, it's quite simple. Do you have YouTube on your phone?" So the officer said, "We're not supposed to use it, but we will do to stop you calling." So I said, "Well, my name's spelt differently to my grandfather. He was a Durrant. So if you type in D-U-R-R-A-N-T, murder, solicitor, Surbiton, there is the original news clip that's been uploaded onto YouTube in 2016. I was actually at the house and babysat him by my grandfather the very night he was murdered. So I explained to the police that I'm determined to get to the bottom of this. They apologised for the months of threatening to arrest me, and I hold emails, screenshots from the police telling me that they're going to try and get me arrested. And it was a breach of certain laws, keep harassing the police basically to report this murder, which they said wasn't listed. So they put me through to the historical murder squad in London, where I spoke to a lady called Lindsay Barnes and Susan Stansfield. And they sent me an email, believe it or not, saying, "We can't access the YouTube clip to do with your grandfather's murder. Was it solved? Because we have no record." So I've got that email, which I can share with you, Tony. It's a very serious matter.
Jordan, you've talked a lot about the police procedures around this alleged murder, but you know, why don't you just cut to the chase? Tell us about the act of, especially you were around, apparently he's babysitting you that night. What happened, and what evidence is there that it was murder?
Well, I mean, it is murder. I have the death certificate. It's unlawful. Please watch the YouTube clip, Durrant Murder Solicitor Surbiton. Well, I was babysat that night.
I'm not asking you to say go and watch a YouTube clip. Yeah. Please tell us in your own words.
Right, okay. So I was babysat by my grandfather the night that he was murdered. I got picked up and taken home to my parents with my grandmother, because every month or every few weeks, my grandfather would go to a Masons meeting, and my grandmother would come and stay with our family to have company. Granddad went off that night, went to a Freemasons meeting, paid a bill in one of the pubs opposite the Covent Garden, the Sugarloaf pub, I believe it was called. It's called something different now. He then got a train, I believe, home, where he was spotted maybe by a ticket inspector at Surbiton train station. He then walked down from Surbiton train station to 12 Cranes Park Avenue, where unfortunately his body was then found later that evening by my grandmother and my father, when he did not call in to say that he was getting the last train home from London, which he normally did.
Okay, so apart from the potential evidence of a motive, financial motive, What evidence was there at the scene that it was murder?
Well, he'd been bludgeoned to death on the second floor of the property, and been stabbed as well. So I have his death certificate. It doesn't say his real date of birth on it and his wrong location. Doesn't say he was stabbed. It just says it's an unlawful killing and had contusions to the head. Basically his head had been caved in. If you watch the news clippings of the time, because I was only 7 years old, the clippings say it was such a brutal murder, they didn't know if he'd been blasted to death with a gun.
Just remind us of his name and the date again, please.
Yes, of course. My grandfather was called Mr. James William Durrant, and he was murdered on October the 26th, 1988, in Surbiton at 12 Cranes Park Avenue.
So that's Jordan Durante. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's a fascinating section where he runs through property owned by his grandfather that should have been passed to him, which has now got some mysterious person taking the rents from all these properties. And he's very, very clear. One of the things I love about Jordan is he's absolutely up for naming all the names, the dates, the streets, the house numbers and all this sort of thing, which is what we need to track this sort of stuff down. And another fascinating side of this, Martin, I think, is the way that stuff seems to have disappeared off the police database. Now, we know that a certain company called Fujitsu has now taken over Scotland Yard's criminal database.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think we have discussed this before, but I wasn't aware of all the detail. This is a clear case, I would suggest, of financially motivated murder. You've got a clear motive. Means motive and opportunity. It's all there, isn't it? And the police should have investigated, but they didn't.
Well, and also, of course, with the
Freemason connection.
Well, we've got a Freemason connection here too, because his grandfather was treasurer of the Freemasons' Hall in Covent Garden, and he never made it home. He made it close to the house, but he was bludgeoned to death, apparently, just before he got home that night. And the police can find no record of it. I mean, the interesting thing about Jordan is he's got the evidence. I mean, for example, there was a news report about his grandfather's murder, and yet the police were saying we don't know that it's even happened.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? That's suspicious in itself.
Well, this is the danger of putting everything on databases. Someone can hack in there and delete it. Yeah, so it just amazes me that the police still use these idiotic methods where if you're a serious organised criminal, you can
cover up through the masonry connection.
Yeah.
We're dealing with organised criminals here.
Thank you, Martin, for joining us from Herefordshire tonight, and hope to see you next week after half term. And we'll finish off tonight with some Satanists. I know that's one of your favourite subjects, so you won't necessarily want to be involved. But this is actually, I think, interesting. It's about an SS dagger described in the Occult Experience. A documentary about paganism, Satanism and religions. And a fascinating documentary is too. I'll put a copy of the whole thing up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
On this altar is one of a number of daggers which we may use in our rituals. This one happened to belong to the commanding general of the most elite unit of Germany's infamous SS. Was concerned with black magic and occultism research in general. Anything that it could find that had to do with the origins of the human race, destiny of humanity.
The perverted view of the occult held by Heinrich Himmler was of an evil magic that could help create a new master race. Wewelsburg Castle is where he performed his ceremonies.
I have been to the Wewelsburg, which still preserves Heinrich Himmler's ritual chambers to this day, and have conducted a black magical ritual in the so-called Hall of the Dead beneath the Wewelsburg. This particular dagger is inscribed to our comrade in the Leibstandarte, Theodor Wisch, Brigadefuhrer, a major general in the Waffen-SS. And on its blade, it bears the inscription, Mein Ehre heißt Treu, or My Honor Shall Be Known by My Faithfulness.
So there you go. some satanic group using these nice little SS daggers. How sweet of them. I think it's a really interesting topic, the way that these things have been sort of inculcated into... there's a complete ignorance, of course, about Satanism. It's not supposed to be there. It doesn't happen. I mean, in my own mind, I do see it as a kind of extreme form of atheism, where those that are loyal to the satanic cults actually don't believe in any kind of life after death. They don't really believe in God or anything like that, but they just believe in themselves. It's a kind of elevated narcissism. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests. That is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Isaac Kneebone Hopkins. And of course to John Shipton, the father of Julian Assange. Shame that Vanessa Bealey couldn't switch her phone on when she promised me that she would be there between 7 and 8 this evening. I might even share that text from her saying, yeah, that's fine, cool, speak to you later. So I hope nothing's happened to her, but I do think that maybe she's just using this as a way to send a signal that she's not really interested in being on our show. Also thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Do download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, our email addresses, and you can even subscribe to my weekly newsletter. And even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Just a little snippet I picked up this week, where we're allowed to still do a few stories, is that Blair and Mandelson were brought back in by Starmer, if and when he almost certainly will become the next Prime Minister. So stand by to see Mandelson and Blair back in government. Maybe Lord Blair, well, of course, just like they did to Cameron with the Tories. This, again, I think, is just Charles, his mates. Blair being in the Order of the Garter, of course, as well, along with Camilla, who apparently, according to the Times, wears the trousers. My paperbacks about deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II, that's The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. That costs £15, just getting that reprinted, I hope. And a secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana Association, that's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. You can get them both on eBay, but the easiest way to find them, and the e-versions and the free versions, is just go to www.bilderberg.org, bilderberg.org. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. I'm off to have a lem sip now, have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
While we're on the subject of hard work, I just want to say that I always was a man to work. I was born working and worked my way up by hard work. I ain't ever got nowhere yet, but I got there by hard work. Work of the hardest kind. I've been down and I've been out. I've been disgusted and busted and I couldn't be trusted. I worked my way up and I worked my way down. I've been drunk and I've been sober and I've been baptized and I got hijacked. I've been robbed for cash and I've been robbed on credit. Worked my way in jail and I worked my way out of jail. Woke up a lot of mornings and didn't know where I was at. The hardest work I ever done was when I was trying to get myself a worried woman to help ease my worried mind. I'm going to tell you just how much work I had to do to get this woman I was telling you about. I shook hands with 97 of her kin folks and her blood relatives, and I done the same with 86 people as just her friends and her neighbors. I kissed 73 babies and I put dry pants on 34 of them as well as others. Done this same thing several times as well as a lot of other things just about like this. I held 125 wild horses and I put saddles and bridles on more than that. Harness some of the craziest and the wildest teams in that whole country. I rode 14 loco broncos to a standstill and I let 42 hound dogs lick me all over. 7 times I's bit by hungry dogs, and I's chewed all to pieces by water moccasins and rattlesnakes on 2 river bottoms. I chopped and I carried 314 armloads of stove wood, 109 buckets of coal, carried a gallon of kerosene 18 miles over the mountain, got lost, lost a good pair of shoes in a mud hole, and I chopped and weeded 48 rows of short cotton, 13 acres of bad corn. I cut the stiggerweeds out of 11 backyards, all on account of cause I wanted to show I was a man and liked to work. I cleaned out 9 barn lofts, cranked 31 cars, all makes and models, pulled 3 cars out of mud holes and 4 or 5 out of snowdrifts. I dug 5 cisterns of water for some of her friends, run all kinds of errands, played the fiddle for 9 church meetings. I joined 11 separate denominations. I joined up and I signed up with 7 best trade unions I could find. Paid my wages, my dues 6 months in advance. I waded 48 miles of swamps and 6 big rivers, walked across 2 ranges of mountains, crossed 3 deserts. I got the fever, sunstroke, malaria, flu, moonstruck, skeeter bit, poison ivy, 7-year itch, and the blind staggers. I was give up for less, lost and dead a couple of times. Struck by lightning, struck by congers, struck by friends and kinfolks, as well as by 3 cars on highways and a lot of times people's hen houses. I've been hit and run down, run over and walked on, knocked around. Now I'm just sitting here now trying to study up what else I can do to show out a woman I still ain't afraid of hard work.
No supper tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. And the battle is getting hard in this Irish Armageddon tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. Remember to kick it over. No one will guide you long in time. Ooh. people sitting down by the light.
Armageddon. Stop it tonight. A lot of people wanna get no justice tonight. Remember.